Tonight on The Download, we reload this week's news with the Chicago Tribune's Kristen McQuarrie and Reuters David Grising, Chicago writer Susan McLaughlin Clark, and Chicago musician Tony Rogers. Now, here's your host, a man who has been called the taste of Chicago, Justin Kaufman.
That's gross. Good evening, everybody. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Woo! Love Fridays. Big fan of Fridays, whether you're getting out of town, maybe wrapping up the week, having a cold one on the porch, or starting work like Pete and I are tonight. We're lucky to have you. Appreciate you being here listening to the download, and we reciprocate that. Your effort to listen to the radio with good programming tonight. Kristen McQuarrie, David Grising in studio to reload this week's news. Awesome to have those two. Perfect. I couldn't think of two people with politics background, covering business, the State House, both in editorial roles, to give us a good understanding of what's happening with this week's news, especially what's happening in Springfield. Kristen McQuarrie and David Grising. Reload this week's news. What's the biggest story? What's the overreported? What's the underreported? It's the winners, the losers. And which story is going to be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 50, 500 years from this week? My guess, All-Star snub? Possible? Also, because speaking of All-Star snub, Kevin Powell's going to stick around. We're going to talk a little bit about the Cubs. We won't have a chance to talk about them, as over the weekend. Downloads only on Monday through Friday. So we'll talk a little bit about their first half and what we can expect from the second. They won today, of course, but let's talk more about the struggles, the hangover. I was reading something that this is kind of unprecedented for a Pete. You might have the answer on this, but it's unprecedented for a team that has won the World Series to be this mediocre the next year.
I saw a thing on Nate Silver's 538. It was how they're suffering from the biggest hangover, because I think last year their run differential was they were plus 250 something, and this year going into whatever last week's games they were plus 25.
Wow. So this is a real hangover. This is not just sort of, the competition is stiff. Oh, they're not getting the same breaks they had. Oh, it's early in the season, they'll rebound. No, when you break down the stats of the 2017 Chicago Cubs, there's some alarming deficiencies.
Very similar to the 1997 Florida Marlins, the Jeff Conine led Marlins. And then when they won the World Series, of course, and then they, everybody left.
The hard part about stats and the overwhelming, the sabermetrics of baseball today is that Cubs fans know this. I don't know. The 85 Cubs ring a bell. The 1990 Cubs ring a bell. You know what I mean? Like, it seems like there's something about the Cubs teams that have been successful that the next year afterwards, they're not as successful. I mean, you don't need stats and Nate Silver and 538 to tell us that. It's just sort of takes one pitcher, a Sutcliffe, to go down, and we're like, I guess we're mediocre.
And save for 5, 6, 7 years, going into the All-Star break at 500, you're like, we're right in this thing.
Right. Yeah. A couple games back?
Yeah.
So we'll talk with Kevin about that coming up as well. News, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier and Roger Badish. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. And this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. We'll come back to do the carryout. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Now it's time for the carryout. This, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news. So you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Just a sec here. Yep, just checking. We still have a budget. Good. All right. Didn't take it away. Today, the attention in Springfield turns to calculators and tables to find out exactly how much more we're all going to pay to live in the state of Illinois. Politically, was it a win for Madigan and the Democrats or Rauner and the Republicans? Or how about anybody else? Anybody, please? Not unlike anything in this world, both sides have dug in and logged in to let everyone know whose fault it is. Don't do it. Don't do it. Shut down Facebook right now. It's not worth reading the comments. Don't read the comments. Ah, you read the comments. But at least everyone recognized that even though we do have a budget, we are nowhere near being out of the woods. It's like we're at the doctor and they're like, technically, it's not broken. But have you heard of a hairline fracture? Yep, the state of Illinois has got a hairline fracture. And what's the medicine for that? That's right, 6 to 8 weeks of rest. So expect lawmakers to get off their feet and relax for the remainder of the summer. School funding? Nah, nobody cares about that. We'll work on that the minute before the deadline. Or more accurately, 4 days after the deadline. Can I get a straw in this lemonade? I'm a state senator. I demand a straw in this lemonade. Sears and Kmart planning to close 43 more stores. Damn, how many Sears and Kmarts are there? Seems like every week they tell us that 40 more stores are going down. This announcement was met with the same, this is the death of retail as we know it. Oh, this is terrible for retail, which, let's face it, it's a retail we can live without. I'm sorry. I know a lot of good people are going to be losing jobs, and that's the sucky part. But Sears and Kmart shouldn't be the shining example of how retail doesn't work in 2017. Because when you walk in their stores, it feels like 1988. Nobody wants Tommy Bahama shirts or that electric juicer or DVDs of the 2007 Roscoe Flatts concert. I don't care if it's in the discount bin. Nobody wants it. The digital music company SoundCloud announced it's cutting almost half of its staff in an effort to become more profitable. Oh, really? I thought they cut half of their staff because they wanted to expand. No, it's because they want to be profitable? Okay, got it. Of course, that seems to be the norm nowadays. At least corporations used to use words like, quote, efficiency or competitiveness. Now it's just straight up, yeah, we aren't making enough money. So where can we get more? I know, we'll take yours. Anyway, Apple, Spotify, it's your lucky day. You get my spins. SoundCloud, you're out. In national news, Black China has filed for a restraining order against her ex-boyfriend and father of her child, Rob Kardashian. Kardashian went cray on Instagram the other day, told the world she was cheating, went as far as to post nude photos of her, which Instagram promptly took down. Now lawyers are suggesting that Kardashian could be arrested for revenge porn. Wow. Crazy amount of drama for a promo for a TV show. Right? You know it's just teasing up season 3 of Rob and China. I guarantee that's what's coming. Also, first name Black, last name China? I'm just trying to, like, is her dad Ted China? Just trying to figure it out. Okay, got it. In weather, some tough thunderstorms today, but mostly just hot. Time to set the old slip and slide up in the studio tonight, right? In sports, Cubs get a victory over the Pirates at Wrigley this afternoon. Non-All-Stars Anthony Rizzo and Chris Bryant went crazy. They got yard. Bryant hit 2 home runs. Cubs currently 4 games back of the upstart Brewers, who are doing their part to prove to the world that they are real. Yesterday, they annihilated the Cubs in a makeup game. The Cubs are hoping for a big weekend series here before the All-Star break because they need to seize on any momentum that they can. Winds blowing out? Momentum. A 1-2-3 inning for Arrieta? Momentum. That beer guy coming around at the exact moment that you need a beer? Momentum. Take it. Also, Kyle Schwarber's back. He got a hit today. Boom. Momentum. We're on our way. Bryant didn't make the All-Star roster. He was outvoted by LA Dodger fans that gave it to Justin Turner. Right, the red-bearded third baseman. Then when he comes up to bat, you're like, I'm going to go to the bathroom. That's the guy who beat Chris Bryant for the final All-Star spot. Something's up. I bet the Russians are hacking the All-Star voting machines. Where's CNN when you need them? Get on the story. The White Sox open up a set at Coors Field tonight at the NL wildcard leading Colorado Rockies. The only big news to come out of the South Side. The Brewers are showing interest in Jose Quintana. The trade deadline's in a couple of weeks, and Quintana's a hot commodity. The Brewers would be a great fit because they've been bad for a long time, right? So you know they got some minor league talent. Get some of that. Also, Melky Cabrera is super hot right now, so ship him too. Who else do we know has great major minor league talent? Too bad they can't just ship them to themselves. Right away, I'm like, the White Sox, they've been bad for years. Oh, right, Also, the Sox lone bright spot, Avisail Garcia, out with a sprained finger tonight. Momentum? Possibly. NBA free agency is all hot and bothered this week. Lots of mid-level movement. Most of the stars have been signed. Well, except Derrick Rose. Remember, this is D. Rose's big max contract year, the one he talked about when he was on the Bulls. Remember that? When he said, I'm waiting in 2 years till I get my big max contract? Here it is, and nobody wants you. Yikes. He had his rights renounced by the Knicks today. He visited the Timberwolves. They signed Marcus Teague instead. He visited the Clippers, who signed a Serbian superstar. And he's also been linked to the Milwaukee Bucks and the Dallas Mavericks, both in backup bench roles. Hey, I got an idea. I mean, we do need a point guard in Chicago, right? I'd take him back. The only people who wouldn't want him back are sports writers and team management. Fans, we'd love it. How great would that be? He comes back, plays like 2000-whatever. You know, we lose in the Eastern Conference Finals to LeBron and the Cavs. That's the best-case scenario of all time for this Chicago Bulls team, right? Bring D. Rose back and give him a new headphone contract. And why not? Let's get on the Chicago Fire bandwagon. Looks to be a 4-alarm fire in Bridgeview. Hey. I can do some marketing for the soccer club. They're blazing hot right now, leading the Eastern Conference with 19 games played. This is somewhat of a surprise because the Fire were pretty bad last year. But they're turning it around. Can they hold off Toronto? Or the New York Red Bulls? Or the Seattle Sounders? Or the Montreal Impact? Or the Houston Dynamos? I just like saying these team names. Great, right? Soccer names, they're fun. It's fun, yeah. And finally tonight, the Taste of Chicago is underway, and it's going to run through the weekend. It'd be too easy to sit here and rip on the festival with its turkey legs, its boneless rib sandwiches, its $10 beers, its concrete curbs that you sit on. So instead, I'll point out the positives. It's almost over. No, that's a carryout for July 7, 2017. God, kid, I love the Taste of Chicago. I saw my first and only Ohio Players concert there. Roller Coaster, right? Greatest song ever. Roller Coaster, right? Of love. All right, coming up, Kevin Powell's going to join us. We'll talk about the Cubs at the All-Star break. Also, Kristen McQuarrie and David Greising in studio to reload this week's news. It's a download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you tonight, my friend?
Here it is, buddy. Play-by-play from a Chicago Fire game. You just can't get enough of it, you know what I mean?
We should become the Chicago Fire, like, the ultimate show that's into the Chicago Fire. I'm taking a lot because I don't pay attention to soccer, but I feel like we should get behind the Fire. They're the only winning team here.
Not a whole lot of people know this, in part because I was probably the world's worst soccer play-by-play announcer.
No,
but I did did the Montreal Impact.
You did?
For about 2.5 years.
We've got a Montreal Impact announcer?
On radio station CJAD 800 in Montreal, I did the Impact for about 2.5 years before I moved back to Chicago.
I saw the Montreal, made a reference to them, and I was like, I should ask Martier about that.
Hey, earlier during Crosstalk with Roe, you guys were talking about the memes.
Mm-hmm.
The funny one that I've seen recently was the one where there's a CNN head on a hockey player, and it's taken from the movie Slapshot. And it's as the one player with the CNN head is skating by on the blue line, one of the Hanson brothers.
Right.
And the Hanson brother just lays out the CNN guy. It was hysterical.
Nothing better than the CNN head memes. Right? It's really, really a cottage industry.
I mean,
it
was so stupid. I was laughing, but it was that dumb.
That's good stuff.
Yeah.
Kevin Powell in studio. We're going to talk Cubs. Before we do that, 773 says, yo, Dustin. I like, it's Justin, but it's okay. I like Dustin. I guess you could say that this year the Fire is a little engine that could. Yeah. So we're going to do that tonight. We're going to have some puns.
I get it.
Also, a shout out to Donald, the Uber driver, for that. So there you go.
I'm kind of excited about the Chicago Fire. I think because I hate to even use this analogy or comparison, but like if a team emerges out of nowhere and they're really good, people will get behind them.
Yeah.
In many ways, the Blackhawks,
I'm not comparing the Flyers to the Blackhawks, but the Blackhawks, for a younger generation, they emerge as like a new team. Like, younger kids are like, who's this Blackhawks team? I've never even heard of it. And then for older generations, it was like, this is awesome. This is a throwback. So it was like the perfect merge
my
of younger and older generations.
It's funny because my generation, Kevin Powell, of course, does sports for Ro and Anna and WGN Radio for a long time here. but I have that issue because my generation, I'm 42 years old, grew up with a Hawks team that was not very good. And actually, when they had their troubles and no one was going and no one was paying attention to them, I'm talking about the Eric Daze days.
Yeah.
That was right when you would be cementing yourself as a Hawks fan. I was 18 years old, 20, 22 years old. I remember being in high school when the team went to the Stanley Cup finals and got swept.
Yeah.
That was like senior year of high school. But after that, it was downhill. So, I'm the generation. It's like when the Hawks came back, I was like, Yeah.
Your generation, even older generations, and then for younger kids, are like, who's this Blackhawks team that's really good all of a sudden? Are they a new team?
What is a sport?
So, like, they totally, were completely attracted to them. Well, so I'm not going that. Yeah. I'm not comparing it. But in some ways, I think people will get behind the Fire if they all of a sudden are, like, competing for the
I just wonder if it's mainstream as well because, they get good crowds that come out there. There's a definite, very healthy soccer population, fan population here in Chicago. So it might just be about the mainstream media.
I'm getting behind the Fire, Justin.
All right.
Let's do it. We're Team Fire, baby.
If we're convert, I'm converting you one by one with WG and
stuff. It was easy for you. Yes.
And I have not watched a Chicago Fire game, but I'm into it now.
Yes.
All right, but let's talk about the Chicago Cubs. Yes. Chicago Cubs, of course, the world champs. A lot sort of as the first half of the year has progressed, a lot of people at the beginning of the year said, hey, they're on track to repeat. We're going to see this rinse and repeat for 4 or 5 years. They're going to be competitive. It hasn't really worked out that way. Nate Silver in 538 said this is the longest hangover or the biggest hangover almost in MLB history, the run differential. What's wrong with the Chicago Cubs that they went from such a dominant squad to a team that is literally 500.
Well, in many ways, last year what they did in all sorts of different statistical categories was unprecedented. I mean, the defense was unbelievable. The run differential, as you mentioned, was nobody had done what they had done before. So you knew there was going to be some sort of regression. I don't think to this extent, but keep in mind, this is still one of the youngest teams in all of baseball. So I'm not one of those that's always going to automatically go to sophomore slump. But okay, Addison Russell, let's look at his number. He's batting 228 with 7 homers and 28 RBIs.
Right.
Okay. He batted, 230, 240 last year but the power production isn't there. 21 homers, 95 RBIs. So, he's dialed it down a little bit. He's been dealing with a nagging shoulder injury. There isn't one specific thing you can point to. Early on in the season, it was like, the pitching. They had been so dominant last year. You have Hendricks, the ERA, lowest ERA in baseball. Lester was right there. This year, it's a totally different story. Now, John Lester has the lowest ERA among starters, and it's 3.94. That's like up a run and a half from
crazy.
Last
yeah,
year.
Right.
So there was that, but then over the past 2 weeks, the starting pitchers have actually been pretty good, save for Mike Montgomery's blow-up throwaway game, 2 days ago. There's things here and there, but the starting pitchers haven't been very good. Okay, well, let's look at runners in scoring position, Justin. Didn't it feel like last year, whenever the Cubs needed a big hit, whenever there was an opportunity to score a run at a timely spot in a game, they came up with a hit? Runners in scoring position this year, they're batting 233 compared to last year, which was 252. And that 252 is over the length of an entire season. So those 20 points, could be spread out as this season moves on. It's just not clicking. Yeah. And I don't think anybody's really been able to identify anything specific. And even Theo said it before this series. He said, look, we're not relying or leaning on a trade. They just simply have to play better. And that is the case. They're just not playing all that well.
Well, let me ask you, because it is interesting, because I think about there has been a strange regression for starting pitching across Major League Baseball this year.
Yeah.
Aces that you counted on have given 7-8 runs early on. But you're seeing course correction. You're starting to see a Jacob deGrom in New York or others that maybe had a terrible start figuring it out. And over time, their stats sort of become the median. They're back to where they were. You're seeing this across the board. With the Cubs being so young, it's hard to tell what you have with a guy like Addison Russell or a guy like Albert Elmora or any of the guys who have to come in and make spot starts. You don't know where the median is at because they've only played one season in this league.
It's a great point. And look, I'm not one of those people throwing up the red flags calling, you know, they do have the luxury of playing in the Central. They're what, just four games back of the Brewers, and the Cubs haven't even played all that well. Not at all. And they're just four games back. Now, Joe Maddon does his Joe Maddon thing and talks to the media and says, hey, we're actually in pretty good shape. You know, everything's totally cool. Like, you know, we're just four games back. Well, you know, I think it's one of those hangover feelings where, you know, I don't really get this sense when I'm in the clubhouse or around the guys, but you can understand or kind of get the sentiment where you felt it in any scenario in life where, like, the Cubs are probably, like, they just kind of kicking the can down the road. Like, oh, we'll win five here, we'll win six there, we'll be fine. And then it's like, well, maybe we're not fine. We're down, we're eight games back in the Central. So I just think there's so much talent here that the, you know, water levels itself out a little bit. I don't think the Brewers can, you know, really run away with this division. So there's plenty of opportunity. Yeah. Now, they are going to make a trade.
Let me ask you this, you know, because I will say this as well. Watch out for the Cardinals because here they come too. They've won something like six or seven in a row or whatever. But, okay, the Cubs, and we talk about trades. There has always been this idea that perhaps the trade would be for someone to add to pitching. They're making a run. Is there any way in any scenario that you see that the Cubs go a different direction and raise a white flag? Meaning they're not going to be the team that is getting the Aroldis Chapman like they did last year. Instead, they're giving up a Wade Davis, or they're giving up, they're restocking, if you will, because they know that they might have enough to get there, but this isn't their year.
No, I mean, the only scenario would be after the All-Star break, you have about 2 weeks remaining until the trade deadline or so. The only scenario would be if they went on some unbelievable losing streak. You know, I was talking to Mark Carman about this, avid Cub fan, as you may know,
yeah,
Justin Cub.
And
this was about a week or so ago, and he was already taunting, you know, floating that idea out there. Let's start moving Wade Davis. Maybe move Jake Arrieta. The Cubs are not, they're not going to do that. They're not going to do that. They have full intentions of not only winning the division and making the postseason, but winning the World Series this year. That's still 100% on the table in Theo's mind and in Joe Maddon's mind, and I think in the players' mind, unless some of these younger guys are getting down on themselves. I think there's enough talent, though, that they can carry it for the full length of the season to make this interesting. But for me, I know they're going to make a trade. They will not be. The Cubs will not be sellers at this. No. It's just not going to happen.
All right.
There's the problem is what do they need? I mean, if you're going to go get a leadoff guy or something, okay. But then who do you take off the roster right now? You're going to put Kyle Schwarber in Triple? I mean, you can't just keep taking pitchers out of the bullpen and create space for a leadoff guy. Who are you going to take out? You're going to take Almora off the roster? You're going to take John Jay off the roster?
Yeah. I mean, if you go out, I don't know who they would be, but if you were going to go out and get a starting center fielder like an Adam Jones or somebody who has the potential to be the...
But is Jones a leadoff guy?
Well, okay, let's say the best leadoff guy there is, then you're going to have to make some sacrifice, right?
Yeah, I don't think the leadoff spot. I know, like, that's what everybody keeps pointing to, but a lot was made of that, you know, obviously because the whole Kyle Schwarber experience didn't work out. But I think they have answers at the leadoff spot. I do. I don't think it's going to be a steady rock at the top like Dexter Fowler was last year. But I've been saying all year I thought Ben Zobrist should be the leadoff guy. Said that, you know, before opening day. I like the idea of Kyle Schwarber, but if it didn't work, I would immediately go to Ben Zobrist. Now, he hasn't been hitting all that well. He's also been dealing with an injury, but I think there's plenty of answers there.
He's very similar to, I mean, in numbers, he's almost identical to Addison Russell. He's 220 with seven home runs.
Yeah, but he's a better on-base guy, and he always works tough at bats. He's a switch hitter. He's a smart hitter. It's exactly what you want. He can run a little bit. It's not
he's
like
got his wife's walk-up music.
Walk-up music, which I actually think he ditched this year, by
Did
the
he?
Way.
We went to the game, and it was Benny and the Jets.
That's what he should play every time.
That's what
like,
he played
no offense. His
but,
wife
it was his,
is,
but it was his wife doing it.
Oh, it is his
yeah,
wife doing
I think
okay.
So, yeah. I
like, well, anyways, there was another one that was like one of her songs, which was, you know, no offense to Mrs. Overs, but it's not like for a, you know, a ballpark. I'm glad he moved on from it. I do believe the answers for the leadoff spot are on the Cubs. I do believe the offensive answers are on the roster already. They need starting pitching for this year and for years to come.
You know what's so interesting about the Cubs is that last year they could not They couldn't find a place for guys like Jorge Soler and others. Like, they just had too much production. This year, and you're really testing the depth of this team with the injuries and people who haven't been producing like Kyle Schwarber. Talk about that. I mean, Ian Happ, a guy that kind of got called up, and they're like, it's going to be a couple spot starts, and he has now found himself as a fixture in the starting lineup for Joe Maddon.
Yeah, and in the middle of the order, which nobody really saw coming. I think Joe Maddon likes him too because he's flexible. Joe Maddon can put him in the outfield. They can put him in the infield. They can move him around the order. And that's what we've seen now from the Cubs the past couple of years. They pluck a guy out of the minor leagues, throw him in, and somehow, I mean, that's a credit to Theo in that. Now, the farm system, here's what I'm interested in to see what the Cubs are going to do. Do they go and get a rental like Aroldis Chapman and give up another top prospect? Do you give up a Candelaria? Do you give up a Happ for a pitcher that you're going to have for 3 months?
What about a starter?
That's what I mean. Yeah, not a bullpen. I'm just using the same comparison to what they did with Chapman, who was a rental, and then he was gone. But you gave up a hefty, hefty price to get him. Now,
He won the World Series.
The World Series, which was fine. So do the Cubs go that route again and thin that farm system? That's certainly not thin, but it's going to get there. With one more trade of some prospects, that Cubs farm system is nothing like it was 2 years ago, which is fine because you'd rather have the big league. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, that seems to be the way that you win World Series these days, is at the trading deadline, you go and get superstars to rent for a couple months. They come in and they make the big plays in the championship series and the World Series. I mean, that seems to be the way a baseball is moving. I mean, you almost have to do that if you're the Chicago Cubs to think about bringing in some all-star, but you're right. You have to give something up to do that.
You have to give up something to do that. Plus, who are the options? There's not a whole lot of you can get rid of the Chris Archer idea. That's probably not going to happen. Tampa can
they're competing
right now. They're going to compete for a wild card spot in the American League. They're not going to give up Archer. Marcus Stroman with Toronto, probably not going to happen. He's a guy they're building around,
and he's young.
He's young and he's controllable. That's what the Cubs want. But why would Toronto give up? You know what
you're
I mean?
You're looking so for it's a like, guy who's going to be a free agent next year.
I'm saying even if you can get a controllable arm, you're going to get a Stroman, you're going to give up. You're going to give up a whole lot. Now there's a guy that I've floated out there for the past year or so, Justin, and his name is Jose Quintana, and it makes so much damn sense. It makes so much sense, except for the fact that the Cubs and Sox play in the same town, which for me, it doesn't matter to me. I honestly, Roe and I were talking about this on the show the other day about why the Cubs and Sox wouldn't make a deal. So, in your opinion, why wouldn't they make a deal?
Mostly because it was either personality thing, bad blood between the teams, or some sort of marketability where they don't want to see their player draw a crowd to their building instead of the other way around.
I think I don't think there's really a whole lot of bad blood between the two teams at this point. I really don't. I think it peaked like 10 years ago and sort of fizzled out since the White Sox have been bad and the Cubs were bad for a stretch of that. I think the marketability, for one, I think that they just don't want to hear about one, they just don't want to deal with it, and they don't want to in sport. They don't want to deal with their players listening to it every day. I mean, there will literally be reports on sports stations in this town every day, update on the Jose Quintana Candelario Happ trade, and they'll put them up on the screen and they'll compare. And you know, I think it's honestly because the sports conversation landscape in media and just in general, so much more intense and scrutinizing and social media, on TV, the newspapers still. Yeah. Like, people are going to dissect this trade forever. And to me, I think the Cubs and Sox should overlook that and just realize the fact that you're going to get scrutinized no matter what you do. There's going to be criticism.
Does it change the... I mean, I agree with you. I think Jose Quintana is a great move for the Cubs.
He's a lefty controller.
Because the Brewers are kicking the tires on Quintana. That was announced today, that they're looking at him and they're sending scouts to watch him pitch. Does it change the Cubs' sort of approach when their rival in the Central, who they're going to be battling down the stretch, is looking at a guy that might be pitching against them?
I don't know for sure if that would motivate Theo or any of them. It could. It certainly could. Maybe it's something that was floated out there, too, to create a little bit more of a market. I don't know, but I just do think that both of the teams should put aside that idea that because of the proximity of the two teams that there's going to be all this criticism and scrutiny. There is. There's going to be plenty of it. But, and I, like I just said, it's a different landscape now. But you look back, like, okay, the Sammy Sosa thing, that's never been some, like, dark cloud hanging over the White Sox organization, no. Right? I mean, I think the sports fan also is a little more educated now where we can, let's say, 10 years down the road, and they were to make a trade, just hypothetically speaking. I think everyone would, you know, there'd be some busting of chops between Cubs and Sox fans for sure. But I think everyone would look back at this time in Chicago baseball and understand why both teams made this deal.
And it certainly behooves the White Sox to get the best deal for the best minor league haul they can, because they are building on the South Side, as we've seen, much like we did with the Cubs in the last 5 years. They're building something. I mean, there is more interest in the team in Charlotte than there is in the team.
There's a reason Comcast Sportsnet Chicago is airing Charlotte Knights games.
I watched it.
I watch it every time it's on. It's actually great because they air them really early. It's like 11 o'clock in the morning.
I love it.
I wake up and I'm like, sweet, I'm watching Johan Moncada.
I'm like, oh, what do we got here?
Right. Yeah.
But, I mean, there's something to be said that the White Sox, I mean, this is a, you know, as we make a quick transition to the White Sox, this is a crucial time for them. This has been the next 2 weeks have been talked about all season long about what's going to happen with some of their veterans and if they can get a minor league haul that will restock essentially the fact when all these other great minor league players come up in the next couple.
They made up a whole lot of ground in the offseason. Rick Hahn did a phenomenal job moving some guys and you know, Chris Sale and Adam Eaton. They got a lot for Eaton, a lot more than I thought they would. They got, I think, a respectable return for Chris Sale. They got what they should have got.
Yeah, he's going to win the Cy Young.
He's going to win the Cy, yes. But Johan Moncada was just named, once again, the top prospect in all of baseball right now. So for the next 2 weeks. Now, here's the thing. With Quintana, they don't necessarily need to trade him by the deadline. Of course, there's the obvious, the risk that he gets hurt. But if he stays healthy and his numbers go back, and he's been really good
his curve, he's coming back after a
100%.
Tough start.
Yeah. The last month or so, he's been good. He's been Jose Quintana, which Jose Quintana is probably a 2 on a good rotation. And if he's a 3, that means you got a really, really good rotation. So if Rick Hahn said this over the winter, they were in conversations of moving Quintana. And he didn't like the haul that he would have brought. So he didn't make the move. Even if Jose Quintana doesn't get traded by the deadline, he still has a ton of value in the winter. And even if he doesn't get traded over the winter, he'll still probably have a ton of value a year from now with a couple more years. So they're not going to force anything. Now, the guys like Todd Frazier and Melky Cabrera, get what you can get for them. I mean, they're free agents after the year. Get rid of them. Get what you can. And I think Frazier could get you a sneaky amount of prospects. I do.
Well, he'll be a bat that power bat that you can use if you're a team in contention. I will say this, and you know, as we pay attention to Major League Baseball at the All-Star break, there is a team in the Houston Astros that are very reminiscent of the 2016 Chicago Cubs. I mean, as you look at it, that I think the Astros
at least the offensive wise, and the pitching's been good, but they've had some injuries here and there where the Cubs had the luxury of but the Astros need another starting pitcher.
The question becomes a team that is all in.
Right.
And has sniffed around on Jose Quintana before.
And this is a year the Astros are doing what the Cubs did and what the White Sox are currently doing. They were horrible for like the past 3 or 4 years, but now you're seeing all that talent rise to the top. But they probably need one more really good pitcher, and they're going to be active at the
And day. I will say, watching a couple Astros games this year, the Astros are much better than the Cleveland Indians. And for the Cubs to get back to the World Series, it's going to be against the Houston Astros, and that'll be a different kind of game. I mean, I'm a Sox guy. I don't like the Indians. I don't think they're any good. They weren't any good in that World Series. The Cubs got lucky they didn't lose that series. You know, it was not. They got lucky. They were a much better team on paper, and they didn't play that way.
You're right about the Astros. Look, if you're a common baseball fan, if you're diehard listening, if you're scrolling around TV at night and you see the Astros on national TV, watch them. George Springer, Correa. I mean, the list goes on. They have a ton of
they're all
Altuve.
23
I mean,
years old or whatever.
Great,
yeah.
Fun players to watch on the team. They're going to be dangerous for a while.
Kevin Powell, he covers the Cubs and sports and also is the sports anchor for the Rocon with Anna DeVellante's program here on WGN Radio. Kevin, thanks for sticking around talking Cubs.
Thanks, brother. Anytime.
All right, good to talk Cubs. Got that out of the way now. We reload this week's news coming up. The biggest stories of the week, the winners, the losers, the overreported, the underreported. Which story sucked you down the rabbit hole and which story will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 20, 50, 500 years from this week? Kristen McQuarrie, David Greising in studio. We'll get to them in just a moment. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio tonight, ready to reload this week's news. Ah, we got a great panel. I'm so excited. Kristen McQuarrie's here. Hi, Kristen. Good to see you.
Hey, Justin. How you doing?
Editorial board member for the Chicago Tribune. And, you know, I was thinking, Kristen, it was about 2+ years ago that you were on with us, right when the State House missed the first deadline for budget stuff. And I remember this because we had a couple of lawmakers call in and you were great. You just yelled at them. And I was just like,
that's what I do.
Yeah, that's what you do. And I was like, yeah, this will get rectified in a day.
Yeah. No, not quite a day.
Two years and change and you're back. Good to see you, Chris.
Yes, you too.
And also in the chair, David Greising. David Greising, the Midwest Bureau Chief for Reuters. Good to see you, David. How are you?
Good, Justin. Good to be here.
All right.
Yeah.
David and I have worked together.
Yeah.
Chris and I have worked together. It's great to have this team together.
Yeah.
All right. So as we tonight, this is how we play. 312-981-7200. We got biggest stories, we got overreported, underreported, winners, losers, which story sucked you down the rabbit hole, and which story will be remembered from this week in 5, 10, 15, 500 years from now. Let's start with the biggest story. I think we all probably agree that the budget for the state of Illinois, the override, everything that happened over the 4th of July holiday, the biggest story of the week. Do we all agree on that?
I did.
Pretty hard to argue with that
one. I did.
Yeah.
What's your take?
Huge income tax hike.
Yeah, I mean, what's your take, Kristen? I mean, you guys at the Tribune have written a lot about the impact and also the culture in Springfield. I mean, what happened here? Just 2+ years of holdouts and pushes for reforms, and we're kind of where we started.
We do. It feels that way, doesn't it? I feel like I wrote an editorial this week that I could have written when I was working for David Greising in 2011 at the Chicago News Cooperative. So it's a big moment, and it was my biggest story of the week because the tax hike is in effect. If you live in the state, if you pay income taxes, you are now paying instead of 3.75%, you're paying 4.9%. That is real money to a lot of people. If you're a single person and you make $34,000 a year, that's an extra $386. If you're a family, maybe making $150,000 a year, you're paying almost an extra $1,700 to the state of Illinois.
Wow.
Into perpetuity. So the fact that we have a big tax hike is a big story. But also, we finally broke this budget impasse that has made us a national embarrassment. And we didn't really get a lot of the reform that the Governor Bruce Rauner was asking for. So in my opinion, that's both of those issues,
yeah.
The political side and the financial side made it the biggest
story.
Well,
let's talk about it, David. I mean, let's first talk about the financial side. I mean, this was a tax hike that was sort of sunset by Speaker Madigan 2 years ago after Governor Rauner said he wasn't going to support it when he first took office. And we're kind of back there. We're back there with the income tax back to where it was, right around the same level. And like Kristen said, none of the reforms that Governor Rauner was pushing for were in this budget.
No, and that's a sign of his weakness politically, but it's also a sign of what kind of killed me this week was watching the celebration on the floor, the self-congratulation on the part of Speaker Madigan and others. Look what happens. We've come together and kind of stepping into their kind of statesman roles when really what have they done? They basically said, well, wait, we need more money. Look around. Where can we find more money? Oh, there's all these taxpayers. Let's go get more money from them. And they haven't really fixed anything. The pension issue is, of course, the biggest financial issue facing the state. And there's no real structural long-term fixes to the pension problem. And so they're really still, as they always have done, kicking the can down the road. They don't have any ideas. The governor, though, hasn't shown that he has any ideas either. He's raised things that are kind of just not really relevant. You know, his push for workman's comp, limitation on workman's comp settlements, et cetera. Some of the stuff he's kind of thrown into the mix has just not been relevant. And that's one of the reasons I think Springfield ultimately said, listen, Governor, whatever, we'll do this, you know, we got this, we'll do this without you. A bunch of Republicans took the risk of voting override his veto. We'll see what sort of price they pay for that. it's really dramatic, a dramatic event, but in terms of long-term fixes, we're left kind of waiting to see when and if that'll ever come.
Yeah, I'm flummoxed a little bit over this because you're right. You hit it right on the head. This is something that could have been written about in 2011, but it definitely could have been a vote that happened in 2015. I mean, we saw a governor who really, I mean, the argument, Kristen, and you guys have been front and center with this at the editorial board, is this difference between budgetary items and ideology. Mm-hmm. And we have seen this over and over about that the governor said these need to be a part of the budget. They're not separate. Democrats said they're separate, yet they have been at stalemate for 2 years. And we get to the end of this thing where we think there's going to be some change, and they're still separate.
Mm-hmm.
I think as someone who is a citizen in the state of Illinois, I'm flummoxed about what they actually did for the last 2 years.
It was really a battle of egos between a Republican governor and House Speaker Michael Madigan. And I mean, our editorial board tends to favor the side of the newcomer, which is the governor who's been in office 2.5 years, not the guy who's been speaker since 1983, except for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so it was really from the beginning, from our position, I mean, Governor Rauner came in. He had 44 bullet points that he wanted to accomplish. Some of them, he got none of them. And really, for the first couple of years, Madigan just was the guy of no. Sent him budgets that were hugely out of balance that he had to veto. I'm not saying the governor is not at fault for failure of leadership, for moving the goalposts a lot, for being unclear as to what he really wanted. But to me, this is more of a show of the absolute power of the speaker and the Democratic leader of the Senate they're not going to give him a win. They're not going to give him even workers' comp reform to the extent that the governor asked for, which small and large business owners alike all over the state are saying, please help us. You know, we've seen the outflow of businesses and residents, and they're so resistant to even a change like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't get property tax. They didn't get a property tax freeze. It does feel like 2011. This was Governor Quinn's plan. Please extend the tax increase. They did a tax increase with no reform.
Now Democrats will say, "Hey, we cut six whatever billion or whatever the number
$3 billion
yeah. out of this." This isn't a bloated. This is actually less of what the number than the governor actually wanted. So what about the concept of Governor Rauner with this idea of pushing ideological reforms? It did work in a certain extent that we got some cuts done in Springfield.
Well, I guess the question is, where does the credit for that go? And I'm not sure that the governor, by basically not really participating in the negotiating process, gets much credit for that. On the other hand, I'm willing to give a lot of credit to Speaker Madigan. Maybe John Cullerton, the president of the Senate, is probably, of all of the major players down there, the one who really worked this the hardest, mm-hmm. Kind of threw out some ideas, some that were good and some that were less good. He was the big pusher, a big pusher behind this whole grand bargain idea that kind of ultimately did lead to this resolution. It was interesting to see Speaker Madigan go to the Senate the day that they voted it through on the Senate to kind of try to kind of step into the spotlight along with Cullerton. So that at least showed a little bit of political mm-hmm. leadership, and maybe that's something to build on. I don't know. Going back to your initial question is like, okay, well, what has changed or what does this build toward? We don't have any working relationship right now between the governor and the two legislative leaders still. There aren't any kind of agreed agenda items that need to be taken up next. It's not very promising.
Okay. So here we come into August, which is the traditional kickoff for a gubernatorial campaign with what's going to happen at the Illinois State Fair. So who's the political winners and losers here? I mean, the governor, quickly at the end, and we were kind of talking about this last night on the show, quickly, I mean, if you're an educated voter, you recognize he's been pushing for, he was pushing for a tax. He knew a tax increase was coming, and he was trying to get something out of it. So it's a little bit disingenuous to turn around and say, I would not vote for this taxes. The Democrats raise your taxes. He was going to do the same thing if he would have gotten something in return. But he's going to run on that. He's going to run on the idea that the Democrats raised your taxes. They just want to take all of the money they can. I'm the reform candidate. Is that going to stick?
You know, it might. And you're right, it is disingenuous because as a candidate, he ran saying he was open to, I think he put 32 service tax hikes on the table. He was open to a shorter extension of the tax hike that was in place in 2011. A couple of weeks before they signed this deal, Republicans came out with a compromise plan that included a tax hike. So this outrage that there was, I think he wanted it. He wanted this. It released a huge pressure valve on his administration. So, yes, he has that one thing to run on. I blocked the Democrats from raising your taxes. But that's it. He didn't get any of his other reforms. So I actually think in terms of winners and losers, they both came out winners. Madigan did too, because he can come out and say, the governor stood on the sidelines. We at least saved the state. We got a budget in place. He's been the person, you know, responsible for the impasse. And isn't that what prognosticators said all along, that in order to break the impasse, they both sort of had to come out with a win? And sort of they did.
Yeah, right. It's mm-hmm. interesting.
Well, the real killer, the one that would have made all of them a loser, would have been, and may yet happen, the downgrade to junk status for Illinois' credit rating. It may have happened. Moody's, which has put Illinois on credit watch, has not yet said what it's going to do. And one of our reporters at Reuters talked to one of the analysts at Moody's who was indicating that this bill itself, they're not really wowed by it. And so that'll be interesting to see. But when you look at it, if there was no deal and the state went into junk status, then Rauner clearly loses because he wears the junk status.
I think so.
Yeah.
Governor Junk, right?
Right, Governor Junk. And so Governor Rauner can come out and say, look, the Democrats raised your taxes and I've preserved the state's credit rating or something, you know, who knows what. But I think that in a sense, he gets a little bit of both. He gets maybe to avoid the junk status, but he gets to rail against the means by which the state mm-hmm. would avoid the junk status. Mm-hmm. So he gets a little bit of both. So in a sense, he has something to go with there. And I think voters will not remember some of the finer points that Kristen is pointing to about, well, he was behind a lot of these.
Well, if they read the editorial page, David.
Before we move on, you covered business for the Tribune for a long time, business columnist, of course, with Reuters as well. I mean, as a journalist who's covered the business landscape here in the state of Illinois, to hear that Moody's wants to downgrade the state to junk, what does that mean to you? I mean, is that spectacular in your mind? Are you like, yeah, this is, I've never heard anything like this? Or is it sort of, no, that's normal. That's 2017 for you.
Well, you know, 5-10 years ago, I never would have imagined it. I remember, speaking of going back to my days at the Tribune 15-20 years ago, I remember some of the do-gooders in town, the business leaders of town coming to the editorial board and saying, well, if we don't start paying our pensions, you know, someday this is going to be a big problem. And it is a really big problem, and the pension underfunding over many, many years, 20-some years at least, is what has put us in the position we're in. The impact on business is, first of all, the embarrassment of being associated with this sort of political dysfunction. And it makes, when you talk to business leaders, they're concerned because it really makes it hard for them to figure out, they think in long-term 5-year, 10-year, 15-year investments. It's hard to figure out like what things will look like in Illinois that far down the down the line. Can they get good people to come to work here when they're paying 25% of their income to taxes, et cetera? It's just, there are all kinds of issues that they think about, but I never would have imagined it would be the first time in history that a state achieved a junk rating.
We're very excited
about that. Junk, yeah, yeah. So
they could take down the Abraham Lincoln statue and put a junk statue. 224 says the silver lining of the budget stalemate: 2 years without a tax increase. So there you go. That's
okay.
Okay, we got Kristen McQuarrie, David Greising in studio. We're reloading this week's news. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll get to winners and losers next here on The Download. Stay with us. We're reloading this week's news here on The Download. David Greising, Kristen McQuarrie in studio. 312-981-7200. We went through the biggest story of the week, which is Springfield. We continue on that thread. Let's go to winners and losers. We'll start with winners. David, you got winners, Republicans who voted to override the veto.
Yeah, and I have in mind, people like Reggie Phillips from Charleston, which has Eastern Illinois University in the district. And it takes some nerve or some self-interest possibly to vote against the governor of your party. He said basically, I'm voting my district. These are the big jobs in my district, and I'd be a fool.
Because that's where Eastern Illinois was.
Yeah. Right, mm-hmm. Right. So, that's when you think about kind of what our representative democracy is all about. You should represent the people you are sent to whatever legislative chamber
politically
you're sent to.
What does it mean? I mean, what does it mean if I forgot what the number was, 10, 12, 14, whatever the number of Republican House members who voted for the override? What does it mean? I mean, politically, are they going to have challengers in the primary? Is there going to be retribution? What does it mean?
So.
You think
Yeah, I do. I agree with David that in some of these districts, maybe not all, they were torn. I mean, Reggie Phillips represents Eastern Illinois University. He's a small business owner. He's really fiscally conservative. He term limited himself, so this was actually his last term. He's a thoughtful guy, and he was supported for his election by some of these right wing groups, and now they are after him. He has a target on his back. I wouldn't say all of them. I don't know that 15 Republicans needed to break mm-hmm. in order to give cover for the Democrats to pass this tax increase. But I think, yeah, you're going to see a lot of them primaried, because all of this stuff that we're talking about tonight, none of it will really register with voters. But they will notice when $1,200, $1,300, $1,400 is missing from their wallets and going to fund what continues to be dysfunction in Springfield.
What about the Democrats? I mean, do you see, because Governor Rauner is going to run on this concept of the Democrats raised your taxes. Do you think that Democrat House members, even senators, might have more trouble in re-election campaigns based on the fact that there's going to be an attack at those seats on the idea that they raise taxes?
A few, but not really. The Democrats have controlled the map of legislative districts, and it's so powerful. In 2011, we had a 67% tax increase that lasted 4 years. Not a single Democrat lost a seat based on their vote for that tax hike. Not one. In fact, the House and Senate got super majorities in 2012 under the new map after they voted for a 67% income tax hike. So, no, I don't see this being as risky for Democrats
right.
as it is for Republicans.
Yeah, under unintended consequences, if the governor does seek retributions and puts up primary opponents against that dozen or so who voted against his veto, whomever wins those races will come out as a weakened candidate, having gone through a primary, and maybe more vulnerable against a decent Democratic candidate. So
might go the other way, yeah.
Right. It would be ironic if they lost some of those Republican seats because of the intra-party battle.
This, I guess, is the part, and this I'm glad to have you guys in the studio to enlighten me here, but what gets me is that it is a Democrat-controlled legislature, both in the Senate and the House. They have, and they have to wear where we're at all the trouble there's been in the last couple decades because they've been in charge. But they get to set the agenda because they have the majority parties, and in this case are able to sort of stall the government. When a governor comes in, Governor Rauner comes in, he says, I want reforms or you're not going to get a budget. They, just as you just said, Kristen, they don't see a challenge. There's no challenge back in their districts. So they could just sit on it. And that's what they did. They just sat on it till Republicans got, started to sweat and said, my districts downstate are losing money. And, they were able, it's almost like they won in this battle of attrition. Like you said, this political ego game of chicken that was played. But because there isn't, the maps are so strong towards Democrats, there doesn't seem to be any competition for those seats. So they don't have to worry about risk.
I mean, that is my opinion, and I'm allowed to say that because I write for the opinion page. I don't see how you can, after decades of sending budgets over to whoever was in charge. I mean, the democratically controlled legislature sent unbalanced budgets to Rod Blagojevich, to Pat Quinn. It didn't matter. If you're going to divvy up blame, which we love to do on the editorial page, it's hard for us to put more blame on a governor who's been there for 2.5 years when as soon as he walked in the door, they basically gave him the middle finger. I mean, he didn't get anything. There was no honeymoon period. Madigan wouldn't even meet with him a lot of times during those first 6 or 8 months that he was in office. The first budget they sent him was $4 billion out of balance. And Madigan said, well, we know this is not constitutionally balanced. I mean, they never gave him a chance to even accomplish some of
and
his
yet,
agenda.
And yet you'll hear Democrats say we're protecting the you know voters who are less fortunate, people who need social services, others in case and Governor Rauner is a pro business, you know, he wants to break the unions. They will say they did that to protect their constituency.
Well, but going back to Kristen's point, if when you go back 25 years, were they protecting those workers by underfunding their pensions? Were they protecting those workers by building up in the last couple of years a $15 billion budget deficit that needs to be repaid through taxes that are levied on these very same people that they're supposedly protecting? So they do bear a lot of this responsibility.
My other winner would be the city of Chicago in this because, you know, it's being bashed over and over and over in the last couple of weeks, you know, with the word bailout and others, this sort of anti-Chicago backlash from Rauner going around the state talking about Chicago is fiscally irresponsible. We got everything that was on the table. Rahm Emanuel walked out with he might have money for schools, but there's more in this budget. I mean, it just seems like even pension.
He got the pension stuff.
So
settled.
I mean, it's just interesting that Chicago, for all of that was happening, that backlash that was happening, they came out sort of looking good.
He did. I mean, the big question mark, though, is they don't have money for Chicago public schools yet. Rauner has to sign this very controversial school funding bill in order for CPS to get this rescue that it needs. But you're right. They got pension relief. He got 911 fees to help supplement some of the pensions. That's what happens when you have a Democratic legislature. And those weren't bad bills to begin with. So.
And Mayor Emanuel was criticized for not going down to Springfield. And it looks like that was probably the right decision. He may have lost more votes by going down. So he got his agenda taken care of by having proxies down there and not doing it himself.
Well, we just did the winners. We're going to turn our attention to the losers because Mayor Emanuel also shows up in that category with his strange fight with the New York Times, the New York media that happened over mass transit. David Greising, Kristen McQuarrie in studio tonight. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, in studio tonight, we're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. We got a lot of great calls and texts that are coming in. In studio, David Greising, he's the Midwest Bureau Chief for Reuters. Kristen McQuarrie, she's the editorial board member for the Chicago Tribune. Thanks for being here tonight. As we've already done biggest story, which said Springfield, winners, which we stayed on Springfield, let's do losers. And I really want to talk to you guys. I've been looking for someone to talk to about the op-ed that Mayor Emanuel put in the New York Times about mass transit. He did it at the beginning of this week, right in the cover of the 4th of July holiday. I think it was on the 3rd. Maybe it was over the weekend. But it was essentially this idea that Chicago gets a bad rap for a lot of different things, but we do great with transit. Mm-hmm. And we should fund transit infrastructure because we're great at it. But the context was in the middle of two big cities, Washington, D.C. and New York, that are having serious trouble with transportation.
He took pot shots at them.
He did. Yeah. It was like out of nowhere. Like
kick them when they're down.
Yeah. And it's in their paper. I mean, it really was sort of, you know, a guy who scores a touchdown at an opposing field and does a really sort of really over the top end zone dance. Like it really felt that way. And the New York media did not take kindly. The next day there were headlines and op-eds against him in the city. What do you guys think? I mean, I put him in the loser category because I don't know if maybe he knew he was going to get this kind of backlash, but it just made all of Chicago go, oh, what are you doing, dude?
I mean, to me, it's one of these moments like who is around you telling you this is a good idea? Who is not? Who are you surrounding yourself with people who are telling you, Mayor, this is going to be a bad idea because we're weak? Okay, our trains are on time, but 104 people got shot over the weekend. So to me, he teed it up for them to just whack him. And so I don't know if it's his ego, if people around him aren't, if he doesn't like to be challenged, and so he has staff who just kind of do what he says. But I thought it was an obvious, huge error on his part.
Is there a strategy to it? Maybe. Well, maybe there's some strategy.
Some stubbornness to him, to this one, because we had an interview with him about a month or so ago, and he brought up out of nowhere how great the transportation system is in the city of Chicago. This has obviously been something that he feels like he has invested a lot of political capital and such in improving the mass transit system, and he's not getting any credit for it, and he's not going to get credit locally. So he thought, well, we'll go to this, to the New York Times and see if maybe they'll let me kind of use up some space. So it's interesting that he just feels like, hey, this is a big one. This is a big win for me. Look what I've done. And the only way to get attention. But like you say, Kristen, he just didn't think, okay, will this open me up to any trouble? And I like how the Daily News, the New York Daily News, put him on his cover with a really unflattering picture.
He put him on the cover.
The headline, Dumb Track Mind. So, yeah, not one of his
now,
finer
I guess,
moments.
I guess maybe he's being talked about in the national spotlight. Maybe it's a Chris Christie kind of thing where any press is press or whatever, like whatever it is. But I don't know what he was doing.
I really think having watched this mayor, it's just he's tone deaf in a lot of ways. And this is one of them. Do you think that you're not especially I mean, we fight over who has the best pizza. We write editorials back and forth about that kind of stuff. You think you can take a shot at some of these transportation systems and they're not going to take a really powerful shot back? One of the headlines was, well, at least our commuters don't get shot on the way home. The Mayor Emanuel has failed to recognize from day one that crime is going to be his legacy. That's his as we stand right now. You know, you can do your speeches in Washington, D.C., and you can talk to the press club, and you can fly to Canada, and you can do all this stuff, and you can be on CNN as a political pundit. Great. You had 104 shootings over July 4th weekend. That is appalling. And everyone else in the country gets it.
And it's becoming, I mean, a national storyline because of the way that the president's approached it, using Twitter to call out that this is something that is unacceptable in Chicago. I mean, I put that in the loser category as well. I mean, the 4th of July weekend, a really weird anomaly where 3 days they seem to be on top of it in the last 12 hours of the weekend, 42 people.
They did a little victory dance with the press conference.
They had a press conference before,
on the 4th and, you know, saying, look at all these guns we've seized, et cetera. And then in that next 12 hours, things just completely blow up. To get a sense of perspective, the last time that we had one of these four-day July 4th weekends, there were 74 shootings. And that was 2013. So the increase is almost 40% increase in the number of shootings that happened over a similar four-day period. So that gives you some sense of how much they've lost control over what's going on in the streets. And then, of course, the other thing is where these shootings happen. And of those 100-some shootings, the bulk of them happened, again, late on the 4th. I think like one of them happened north of North mm-hmm. Avenue.
Right.
And it's kind of a segregation, and, economic segregation.
I guess I put in the loser category too, and I don't mean this for any of the officers, but the Chicago Police Department, they were talking about implementing a strategy that they used on Memorial Day weekend. They made a lot of hay of that at the press conference as well, this concept that they had a way to take on violence, and it's working. And then to see it not work in the way that there's a 40% increase, that's a bad look for the Chicago Police Department strategy.
It is. They're frustrated, too. I think that was the Tribune's headline. They're frustrated all around. You know, there was a front page photo either July 4th or July 5th of police officers, you know, like grasping some of these victims' families. And, you know, they are affected by it just as much.
And then, you know, the idea of when things go bad, they then get even worse. They've got this new technology, the shot spotter technology that was supposed to be
one of the magic fixes.
And it was faked out by fireworks that people were putting out on the street. Mm-hmm. Every time they heard something explode, they thought it was a shot. And so that system proved to be completely useless. And that's just one of those cases where when things go bad, they go really, really bad.
They really do. I mean, and there was a lot of hope. I mean, there was a lot of hope around this 4th of July weekend. What do you do if you're the Chicago police, the mayor? I mean, a good point to be writing about mass transit, the tone-deaf part you mentioned. I mean, to be writing about that when the city is having this issue, a 40% increase from the last four-day weekend. What do you do? I mean, obviously the feds are coming in, ATF data agents and others that are coming in. There seems to be more interest in trying to get the federal government to help out. But what is it? Does the mayor, like you said, his legacy is crime? Does he double down, or does he recognize that it's just not a winnable issue?
I really don't think he's tried. I mean, if I were mayor, I mean, the day that he came in, these hotspots should have been his primary focus. I don't care about the Riverwalk. I really don't. I don't care about Navy Pier. Really don't. Crime everywhere in the city affects every part of the city. Why wasn't he having caucus meetings, a special caucus with all of the aldermen who represent these areas? Why weren't there connections made between Northside aldermen and what they can do to help bring businesses to Southside neighborhoods? I mean, this is all, a lot of it is economic development and jobs, and he's been really slow to try to make some of these connections, and it should have been priority number one. Crime was bad when he was elected. And I feel like this whole idea of, we have 50 wards in the city, and aldermen who are in charge of a few square miles and get paid a lot of money to keep track of them. The silos in the city should have been broken down on day one, and you should have had meetings with, what can Brendan Riley, where we're sitting, do for Kerry Austin in the 34th Ward? None of that seems to have happened. I don't know why.
You know, he has made some efforts, some of the food, so-called food deserts. He's worked to bring companies, decent grocery stores, for example, into some of these poorer neighborhoods. Certainly, he's had several different police chiefs, each of which has tried some new sort of tactic. In a sense, on the policing part of it, it's a mystery nobody really has a solution for. And I feel like he has given some effort to that and a fair amount. I think he recognizes the political vulnerability that he has. So I think he's given some effort. I just think that trying to solve that problem is so monumental, because it really is. It's an economic problem. It's a social problem. It's not the crime. The shooting is only the tip of the iceberg of the bigger underlying problems, none of which have an easy solution.
Yeah, it's a hard issue to untangle, like you said. And you saw that the New York Times took a shot at the mayor for the way he's handled what possibly could or could not happen with a consent decree and police reform, an issue in which, you know, he, after what happened with Laquan McDonald, we saw, you know, a push here in the city of Chicago that we needed something to change. We saw a Department of Justice, a scathing report that came out saying there needs to be training and retraining in the Chicago police force. And yet here he is in a very delicate situation, because it is delicate. He's got a new fraternal order of police head at the union there, police contract that's coming up here, kind of waffling a bit, hoping people forgot. You know, like that seems
we
to
got
be,
it. We got it. Yeah. We don't need the Justice Department.
You don't need that. Yeah, I'll take care of
this. Yeah, we got it. We got it.
And it again, I think it points to this idea that he has an image that he's not doing as much to take on an issue that's really important.
And for somebody who gets all these accolades for what great political instincts he has, to defer that to the federal government would have been a smart political thing for him to do, because then he has somebody to point fingers at if things aren't going well. The real fact of the matter is, under the current Justice Department, they're probably unlikely to actually want to execute a consent decree anyhow. So it's kind of almost that whole consent decree issue, him saying once at one point agreeing and then changing his mind once the politics change on it. That's just kind of a self-inflicted political wound by Rahm Emanuel, which goes back to your point about kind of him just sometimes having a tin ear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he still is resisting. Even the consent decree that they've sort of tried to come up with, after you have the scathing report, I think it also, you know, he doesn't want anyone meddling. He's been very abrasive when Trump has raised this on social media, when in fact we do have a terrible crime problem here. I don't really care if Trump is tweeting about it. It's accurate. It's true. it's a bad deal here. But he doesn't. He's very controlling. He doesn't want somebody else to be able to somehow derail what he's doing or interfere. And to be fair to him, federal consent decrees are a pain in the rear. I mean, you have somebody in your face, you have somebody over-regulating, watching your... No mayor really wants that.
And he took a lot of pride in finally bringing to an end the Shachtman decree, which for years dictated who got hired for what kind of jobs in Chicago. That decree was designed to get politics out of hiring in the city of Chicago. Thank goodness that problem is solved and we no longer have politics involved in the hiring of city workers.
David is crossing his fingers as he says that. Yeah.
David Grising, Kristen McQuarrie in studio tonight, 312-981-7200. I got some texts. I'll get to you guys as well. 312-981-7200. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Overreported, underreported. It's The Download. Stay with us. All right, we're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. All right, let's get to overreported and underreported. I always love these categories. You know, overreported is one that's, I mean, David, you have on your list overreported what we just talked about, Emanuel and the New York media. But there is something to that. I mean, it's overreported on purpose. Like, there's this beauty in the fact that it really means absolutely nothing, and yet we love it. We love the rivalry. We love it.
Yeah, and I, you know, just the number of column inches that have been spilled on that silly little story, it just really, really struck me. Neil Steinberg in the Sun-Times today called it, anger porn or something like that. It's like, it is one of those stories, you're right, we just love, but it really does add up to just about nothing.
Yeah,
that's why
I love those stories too.
Yeah,
so I'm quizzing you on what I think the overreported story was.
So
you knew this. You knew this,
on live radio.
You knew the state budget impasse was bad. We can't pay any of our bills. We're way behind on pensions. We have a huge unfunded liability. What was the story, do you think, in the past week where people were like, "What? You can't pay for what? Anybody? Anybody?
Lotto."
Yes.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
I mean,
I have that on
seriously?
My list too. I can't believe that became the pullout of what's going to get us a budget is the lotto. We can't play Mega Millions. Can't play Mega Millions, guys. We need a budget. Everyone roll up their sleeves. We can't play Powerball. Yeah, exactly. That's the dumbest story.
Like, but it was, that's what galvanized people. Or maybe it was just the media overreporting it. We have been in the friggin' hole in this state for 7 years, maybe, trying to get a budget, trying to get our pensions funded. The second we can't pay out lottery winners or Powerball friends to leave.
No, we got kicked out of Mega Millions.
We got kicked out of Mega Millions. And suddenly the legislature's like getting serious.
Right. There's something to be said about that. I mean, it's funny that politics will play out, and especially in the state of Illinois, which, I mean, I put in the underreported category the fact that, you know, we saw an overreported story in Governor Chris Christie on the beach in New Jersey, right? But I thought the underreported part of that is that it was a government shutdown because they were having a budget showdown. Not unlike Maine was doing the same thing at the same time. And they had days, not months, not years, they had days to figure this out. And it made me think, wait a second. Why in the state of Illinois are we on 2+ years of doing this when Chris Christie's on the beach for a day and they got it fixed?
Right.
And it's because, you know, there's so many underreported things about why we don't have a government shutdown in the state of Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt like even through the overreported, you know, everything that was coming out, that's the story that we should have been talking about. Why in the first place have we let lawmakers bend the rules to not hit their deadlines?
Mm-hmm. You know, if you were in a state where Chris Christie was on the beach and having pictures taken of him, you would put the government back to work too to get those beaches.
Get him out of the lawn chair.
Get him out of the lawn chair.
Put some clothes on the guy.
I also had for overreported before we get to underreported, but the G20 protests. And you know, it's a big deal happening right now in Germany, the idea that, you know, they're protesting. But there was so much made that Trump this, Trump that. I don't know, from being a G8, the G8 being here in Chicago for the NATO protests and knowing, you know, wherever leaders meet, there are protests. I feel it's unfair and overreported that this has to do with Trump. I just think that there are protests every time the countries get together in any sort of form. And I felt it was a little disingenuous to act like this was a new thing, especially since, I mean, for Chicago, what was it? 5 years ago? Mm-hmm. When was it when McCarthy won the hearts of Chicago by beating up some hippies?
2011, 12?
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? Like, there's always protests around summits like this.
Right.
And I felt like
it
was overreported. It was because of Trump.
So it's a good thing then that President Trump in Poland talked about fake news and what terrible media we have, because we were overreporting protesters in Hamburg who.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
I was watching I think it was CNN, and they did. They just. It was the same B-roll over and over and over. You know, it was, you know, a few hours of people clashing with police, which, as you mentioned, we had here.
It's professional protesters.
And it's the 24-hour cable news. They literally just kept playing the same footage over and over.
Now, the weird Podesta tweets and stuff this morning, that there's been enough coverage of that's good. You're right in a sweet spot on that. But the protests, I don't agree. So. Yeah. All right, so let's do underreported. As I mentioned, David, I mentioned mine, which was why there isn't a government shutdown. But you have the future of the Sun-Times, Peace and Cranes today. There seems to be a lot of hyperbole being thrown around.
Well, there does, and the worrisome one, which I think is a thinly veiled threat, but nevertheless, Rapports, the company that owns the Sun-Times, have basically said that if they can't get a deal approved, either with the current bidding group, the led by former Alderman Edwin Eisendrath or the Tronc, the company that owns Tribune, that basically they'll consider shutting down the Sun-Times. And I think that may be the first time that anybody owning the Sun-Times has gone on record with that as an option. And when people start saying things publicly, that's the time when you kind of start paying attention. Even if it appears to be a threat to get government approval for a deal, it's still kind of worrisome to hear that. And my ears perked up when I saw that in Lynn Merrick's story in Cranes today.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good one. I didn't have that one, David. But that you're right, it has been underreported. And just all the I don't really get so much of the angst about the Chicago Tribune buying the Sun-Times. I guess I'm maybe naive in believing that our people really will allow the two voices to be heard because that's in their best financial interest too. So I haven't been all worked up about the loss of the Sun-Times, but that was, you're right, that's pretty serious when they say, we're going to close our doors. And we've sort of known that's coming though, right? They're really struggling, not turning a profit, laying off and not filling people. The paper itself is very thin. So maybe we shouldn't have been surprised.
Yeah.
But seeing it, yeah.
Yeah. And again, let's not get overly alarmed because it is clearly it's a negotiating tactic. Mm-hmm. They're trying to get the Justice Department to clear this deal with the Tribune, which is the best deal they have on the table. But nevertheless, when you start saying that publicly, it's time to pay some attention.
Yeah. The other story that I have for underreported and overreported, just for fun, if we wrap this up, is the Cubs. The Chicago Cubs. Oh, my gosh.
I never overreport the Cubs.
I feel
like
they're in overreported territory. But
do you see my eyes rolling out of my head?
But yeah. Kyle Schwarber, you had Kyle Schwarber on an overreported. I mean, the idea of him going down to the minors and coming back and all of this.
Going 0 for 4.
Yeah, just having headlines about him. I mean, the paper is putting him on the front page. I mean, yes, I guess he's a star. I mean, he's the biggest star in baseball, but I don't know why. I mean, he's a guy who we love because he hit long home runs in a playoff series 2 years ago, not even in the World Series.
Right, right. Well, he had a good hit in the World Series.
Don't you guys, don't look at me. I don't know what you're talking about.
I looked at Kristen to bail me out at any time. That's right, that's right. So, yeah, I think he's emblematic of, this kind of interest in every minute little twist and turn. And ironically, the Sox are in last place, and yet they're like the most interesting baseball team in town and one of the most interesting in the league now.
You should be talking about them.
Yeah, I'll take a pass on that one. Yeah, that underreported.
Yeah.
Because the White Sox, for as much as I love the White Sox and what they have in their minor league system, they are also really frustrating to watch. Mm-hmm. They lose. They'll quickly, you blink your eyes, it'll be six in a row. And they are maybe a half game out of the cellar in the American League. So a lot of teams have figured out and righted their course to mediocrity, except the White Sox.
This is the last time I will be doing your show, Justin.
Hey, I'm with you. I'm a White Sox guy. I'm just saying.
I actually don't
watch
them.
This team is bad.
I watched them lose up until the end of the 2015 season. I really didn't watch last year, and I haven't watched much of this year.
You're not missing much. Although I will say, in the next couple of years, they're going to be very exciting. They got some kids that are in the minor leagues that are they have the number one baseball prospect. He's ready to come up, kid from Cuba. And then they also didn't they get the rights on another guy from Cuba when they came around. So they have a lot of talent in the minor leagues. They're just in the minor leagues. As we were talking with Kevin Powell, they show the Charlotte Knights games now on Comcast Sports. So that gives you an idea of what they're going for.
Obviously they're really playing by Theo Epstein's playbook, but maybe it'll work a second time. Who knows?
Yeah. David Greising, Kristen McQuarrie. All right, so when we come back, we'll talk about stories that sucked us down the rabbit hole this week and also which stories will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 20, 50, 500 years from this week.
500.
Wow. Thank you, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman with you. David Greising and Kristen McQuarrie here as well. We're reloading this week's news. We've done the categories, biggest story, overreported, underreported, winners, losers. We're now to my favorite category, which is what story took you down the rabbit hole? Which story did you go in and you're like, oh, I'll click on this link. And you're like, I better go to this. Oh, man. And now you find yourself 2-3 hours in going, wow, I didn't know that. That's the fun part about this story. And David and Kristen, of course, will probably have great stuff. David, what do you have for the story that, that sucked you down the rabbit hole this week?
Mine is the big hashtag CNN blackmail story. this started with a Reddit post of some old World Wrestling Federation tape of then
the matches heard around the world, right?
Donald Trump beating up some
what country? It was Vince
McMahon. He was beating up Vince McMahon in that clip.
Was that Vince McMahon?
Was,
okay,
yeah,
well,
yeah.
In the clip,
you wouldn't
we,
know that,
right? In the clip we saw this week, it was a square with the CNN logo on it. So he was beating up CNN, which. Sure. Apparently, according to the many stories that I then clicked through to, that went viral on the kind of conservative blogosphere.
Well, and the president tweeted it as well, which was
it was his most retweeted tweet, if you can believe that. Think about how epic that has to be.
This
to be
is
Donald Trump's
I know,
most
right?
retweeted tweet.
This is the story. What wow. you're talking about is how it got to the point where he tweeted it. I mean, it had made the circles already. It wasn't like he just found it on a site somewhere. This was already picking up steam in the conservative
It
circles.
Was picking up steam. And then CNN decided, okay, well, let's find out who created this thing originally. They found the person who created it. They talked to this person who it turned out had prior posts that had some anti-Semitic and other horrible things.
Shocker.
And right. But this young person agreed to take all that down. And CNN said, okay, we're not going to reveal your identity because you're a private citizen, which is a questionable journalistic judgment, as I've read in some of the things I clicked through on.
When you were in the hole, the rabbit
when
hole.
I was in the rabbit hole. And then CNN, in its explanation of giving him anonymity, said, quote, CNN reserves the right to publish his identity should any of that good stuff change. And that then, the right-wing blogosphere right. thought, okay,
hashtag.
CNN is blackmailing. That's where the hashtag was born.
CNN blackmail.
CNN is blackmailing this guy that if he crosses the line, if he does any,
so,
CNN is
so
going
did
to
they do
police
all the, did,
this
did,
person's social media
did CNN
life
do all of that after the president tweeted it, or was it was after
that? They were looking, they were trying to
already
find out where did
it,
this
yeah.
all come from.
Yeah.
And so, but then their effort to, for questionable journalistic reasons, kind of protect the identity of this person, then became this horrible blot on CNN, which has had a bad go of it in the last few weeks, where they've had to kind of
yeah. What would be the reason for doing it? They just didn't want to harass this guy, like, you know, put it out there where people can.
Yeah, they felt like, okay, wait, he's gone. He's taken down all his bad posts. He says he's never going to do it again. Their subsequent explanation was that they felt that in good faith he was saying he's going to do this.
Can
stuff.
I ask?
They didn't try to sound menacing the way they
can
actually
I ask
did.
A dumb, dumb question. What is? Who cares? My point being, what did they have a right? Did they say it was a copyright that he had it on, that he used the CNN? Who cares?
No,
you're able to do that. I mean,
maybe because they started to do a story on it, and then they realized this guy did not have clean hands, and then they came up with this weird policy. Well, okay, if he does it again, then we're going to go after just really weird. Really weird stuff.
Gosh.
We do protect the identities of certain people when we're covering stories, but this probably would not be one of them. But maybe they felt if they contributed to him being harassed, his life was probably threatened, and they didn't want to add to that, you know?
Yeah, it used to be where my initial impulse was to scoff that his life, because usually it's the conservatives we think of as the ones who
you know,
are pretty quick with the threat stuff. But after what we saw in the congressional baseball game, where a liberal took a gun and shot up a baseball game, you know, and hit,
I mean, if you're listening,
it's dangerous
it
on
time.
Both sides these days.
I think that you get this concept that for whatever reason, it's a conservative social media user that's going to be someone who is vile.
Just angry.
Or angry. But
angry,
I mean,
but
that's debunked.
It's
debunked on this show, and people text in that there's equal opportunity vile from both sides.
There are radical elements of both parties who have shown very ugly sides of themselves since this election and during.
Well, and it leached into the Springfield events this week, where there were threats being issued. And
so the Facebook pages and people saying you have blood on your hands or something in blood. And blood. Who puts the word blood on Facebook?
I don't know. Yeah. And then somebody sprinkled white powder outside Governor Rauner's office. And so they had to put the whole Capitol on lockdown. I mean, it's gotten really ugly. But I'm guessing that was probably a liberal and not necessarily a conservative trying to mess right. with the governor or whatever was on schedule
it,
that day.
I wonder if what we're seeing is a sea change when it comes to CNN. They're going to take it on the chin for the idea that, you know, here they are, questionable judgment as journalists. But there is this thought about publishing names and having being responsible for the way that social media works these days, where if you make it the SNL writer, Katie, who made the Barron Trump joke, or others who or make an off-color thing, and it becomes a viral hit, and then it just gets at their life. Mm-hmm. I mean, it starts to mess with them. And I wonder if CNN is taking a lead on saying, well, we don't need to do that. You know, like, let's just maybe we know what's going to happen. There's going to be thousands of people that are going to have some impact on this person's life who just made a dumb meme.
Right.
Let's just move on from it, and we told the story. We don't need to say the guy's name. I mean, that maybe there's a change in the way that online journalism is going.
Right, but they seem to take it from a privacy angle, whereas it seems to me that if you post something to the blogosphere, that's not really privacy.
No, it's not.
You're going public with your point of view, and I don't get the decision to, I guess, out of safety maybe, but you could say that it's when you start making rulings on that basis, where does that stop?
Right.
When do you decide I'm going to use this person's name on that person's name?
Absolutely.
That's something journalists have tried to stay away from for many, many years.
Do the rule is this and do the rule, because otherwise right. you get caught up in this net. Wow, mm-hmm. fascinating. Mm-hmm.
Definite rabbit hole material
for me.
A lot of time on that story.
All right, what sucked you down the rabbit hole?
Oh, this is so boring. But you know, the Democrats passed this tax hike and this budget, and they kept saying it's balanced, it's less money than we've ever spent. So I spent quite a few hours going through a 698-page bill.
You did?
Tried looking for pork projects and where was the money balance, and it on paper. It is a balanced budget, but it is predicated on A, B, C, D, and E happening. You know, so many people in the pension system choosing a cheaper one, the legislature also approving A, B, and C. So it's balanced as much as any other budget in state government has been balanced, which is it's not balanced. So
I mean, it's this idea that if certain money comes available, I mean, are they taking allowances on predicted revenue? I mean,
exactly.
That's a huge deal where they're like, we think, sunlight. We're going to – there's more sunlight than the – but then we're going to raise $10 million, like that kind of thing.
Right. They are predicting how much the new tax increase will bring in, and that usually can be somewhat of a solid number. But then as soon as they put that number out, the state's independent auditing arm put out a number saying, you know what, tax revenue is way down because people are leaving. And so, it's all just kind of jello, basically.
Yeah.
And it was a rabbit hole, and a really tedious and boring one. I'm so sorry, listeners.
That's great. Well, what are you talking about?
I didn't see you down there, but, you know, I kind of spent a little bit of time on that one myself. And, you know, some of the stuff that was interesting was they said, okay, we're going to close this $18 or $15 billion shortfall in bill payments. One way we're going to sell $6 billion worth of bonds. Oh, but by the way, we only have enough money to pay off $3 billion worth
right.
of bonds, so we're only going to raise $3 billion this way. It's like when
we're
you look
smoothing.
At,
yeah, we're smoothing, right, smoothing some of these
thing.
Numbers,
I think,
right?
Yeah. I think you'll see these behind the scenes Showtime show, The Circus, and others about campaigns, being behind campaigns. But it'd be great to get a documentary show that's in the budgeting process. That it's just an 8-week episode on HBO where, like, the state of Delaware is like, okay, let's roll up our sleeves. Let's do page 10. Because it's amazing to me, like, how they put these things together.
I mean, I've been down in Springfield before where they start out with a revenue number. We have this much money to spend. And then at midnight on May 31st, they move it. You know, we actually think we're going to get more in from cigarettes, so taxes, poor people are smoking, whatever. It's all just smoke and mirrors. So that's kind of what my rabbit hole was
all right.
this week.
My rabbit hole story, and I have two. I have the one that's the real one, and I have the one that's the – okay, the real one was Rob Kardashian and Blac Chyna. I don't want to make a big deal about it, but I did go in the rabbit hole on that one. It was crazy. But the one we're going to talk about tonight is
– I just have to say my much younger coworker, she suggested that should be one of my overreported. I'm like, who are you – what are you talking about?
What's a Kardashian?
Yeah, I don't know.
Have you paid attention to this story?
No.
No.
Oh, come on, you guys.
Yeah, we're old we don't know. We're not
down,
hip
down
like
other
you.
Rabbit
You're
holes.
So hip. We're not.
There's a guy Kardashian. Rob, and he was on the early shows of Keeping Up with the Kardashians with brother.
Yes.
He then went off the grid.
Yeah.
He cut the show. He was on the show, and he came back, and then he got together with a an internet celebrity, her name is Black China, who was dating another rapper, Tyga. No, maybe not Tyga. I don't think it's Tyga. Tyga might
just
be Kylie Jenner. I'm losing it.
Just describing the rabbit hole he's going into.
Let me roll it back. Okay, so there's a show. It's a reality show. There was some strange drama in which then Rob went to Instagram and he just went on this like hour-long post after post after post after post, calling her out for cheating, calling her out for everything. He put up pictures that
she never would have done that to him.
No, of course. But there's a really interesting takeaway from it, and then we'll move on. It's just that he did all this stuff. He talked about all this private stuff. He actually posted pictures that she sent to him that were of the half-naked variety. Instagram quickly, because it was such a viral hit, everyone was there, they quickly took that stuff down. And now there are laws. There are laws in the books that you can't do that. I mean, you can get felony counts. And so lawyers are looking into whether or not Rob Kardashian broke the law by doing that, even though it's a high-profile case, and he could actually be in trouble, jail time. So,
it's a lot to take in.
All right, let's move on to something much more interesting.
I'm deleting all my nudie pictures to my phone as we speak.
There you go. Okay, so the refusal to turn over election data. That's what I had as a rabbit hole story. I did not know much about this. I thought this was Donald Trump, I thought it was mostly liberal states that were saying, we don't want to be a part of this. But as this story has evolved, 43 states have thumbed their nose to the commission on essentially Donald Trump and put together a commission that was about voter fraud when he first said that.
Chaired by Vice President Pence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what happened here is 43 states have said this is, and mostly conservative states have said, this is what we believe in. We don't give money. It's a federalist issue. The idea that we don't give our information, state information, to the feds. And I thought it was really interesting that it's not really a political party decision. It's not liberals or conservatives. It's actually much more conservative.
Constitutional struggle here, the states' rights issue. Wow.
And Trump actually comes out and Twitter saying, what are you trying to hide? It's just really interesting because it's a lot of people supported Trump. They're just like, we don't give this kind of information to the big bad government.
Well, look at how some of the conservatives are about having like a gun database or, you know, any sort of a database that is keeping personal information on you. No way. It's a violation of liberty in their opinion. So, yeah, they're fighting back and saying, uh-uh. And a lot of the information you could walk into any county clerk's office and get.
Right.
But they're not going to give a helping hand to the Trump administration.
Yeah. I think they're just hiding those 3 million votes that Donald Trump thinks were suppressed.
Think happened? Does President Trump just let it go? Does he drop it because it's not a political, it's too much of a hot potato? There's a lot of people, I mean, I'd love the Mississippi Secretary of State, I think it was, that said, go jump in the Gulf of Mexico.
Right.
Last I checked, that's a Republican state. That's a red state. So it's interesting that, you know, does he drop it because, you know, now he's really kind of ticking off his Republican base?
At 5 a.m. when he starts tweeting, we'll know the answer to that. I don't know. I think this was something, you know, voter fraud is something that the other side has been saying is a huge problem, and voter suppression. And I don't know. Maybe if this... If he gets so much pushback, he has to drop it. What are they going to do?
Well, in a way, it might actually be politically expedient for him to drop it, because it would appear that there's perhaps no basis for the claim that he has made to begin with. And so instead of actually doing a bona fide investigation and discovering that, in fact, there are not those millions of votes out there,
right?
He could just say, hey, listen, the states wouldn't let me do this.
I'm a state guy. I get it. Yeah,
those suppressed votes are out there. Yeah. If only we could prove it. Now I'm going to go and hang out with my good friend Vlad.
We'll see what the ego, if there's ego involved, or he wants to double down on the idea that he wants states to do whatever he wants.
His track record so far would indicate he might keep fighting it, but it might be, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
All right, Kristen McQuarrie, David Greising in studio. All right, let's take a quick break, and we'll come back and we'll wrap it up with the story that will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 500 years from now. Black China, Rob Kardashian?
No, yeah, probably.
Maybe? All right, stay with us. All right, reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. 312 says, Governor Rauner made his wealth as a corporate raider. How does forcing the state into bankruptcy benefit anyone except the leaders who can charge higher interest? Okay. When did Illinois, 312 says, when did Illinois become a winner-take-all sport? I'm old enough to remember back to Governor Jim Thompson. Every governor was willing to work out compromises. Why is Governor Rauner different?
Those compromises were very expensive for the state.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If you had some, I mean, they threw $3 billion, $30 billion. What was the Illinois first plan? $5 billion of pork all around, and Jack Benny statues and stained glass windows in a Naperville parking garage. When there's money around, everybody, you know, they all kind of played along. But when the money got tight, then it wasn't so easy. Yeah.
847 Mary says, I agree with the point Kristen made about Mayor Emanuel. I feel like he should make violence that plagues poor neighborhoods and particularly affects young black men a priority from day one. Instead, in December 2015, he makes a tearful speech about the Laquan McDonald shooting after the video was released. Saddens me that it took for an event for him to make mentors for young black men a priority. And I also agree that I don't care about Navy Pier or the Bean as well.
Yeah. Go Mary. With you. Mary and Kristen.
708 says, Rauner, there's a lot of governor bashing. Usually it's Speaker Madigan bashing. There's a lot.
Interesting. I mean,
but tonight it's Governor Rauner brought us nothing. We lost Hostess, Ford, Oreo cookies, Cocoa Puffs, Heinz Kraft merger, lost jobs.
Under Rauner?
That's what they're saying. And then 708 says, Quinn lost his job because we voted for a four-year increase, not permanent. I will never vote Democrat again. 708 says, Rauner said he would bring jobs, rich businessmen who know how to bring jobs to Illinois. He was supposed to add revenue. That's why we hired him.
I think he would say that because he hasn't been able to get his agenda done, you know, things like workman's comp and tort reform, et cetera, that's one of the reasons he hasn't had more success in bringing jobs. He might also say that he has retained some jobs that were up for bid, like the Caterpillar headquarters, moving to the Chicago suburban area. Caterpillar could well have just said, we're going, out of state, et cetera.
And they
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then 608 gets the last, although 608 kind of gives it away here. My entire family of 25 is moving out of Illinois. There's your impact. You're not the only ones, and they're not the only ones, including all their friends. Good luck, Illinois. Greetings from Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. I get emails and texts like that if not every day, definitely every other day.
I almost had on my rabbit hole story was the memes about how much we actually are taxed. You know, you've seen this over and over in social media. You know, if you're comparing income tax, even with the 4.95, we're still lower than Wisconsin and other places. Now, I understand that they don't have certain taxes and we have other taxes. But when you actually suss those out, Illinois is still, it's still comparable to the other states. So the idea, like, greetings from Wisconsin. Well, as my dad who lives in Wisconsin would say, well, good luck with that.
Well,
they have the same issues. It's 6%.
I believe their personal income tax is higher than Illinois.
They have a graduated income tax.
Right, yeah. But the top rate is
higher
than
much
Illinois.
Higher.
Right,
yeah. I think the issue is, I don't think people are objecting to necessarily paying taxes. It's just that we keep giving money to the state. You know, you're paying taxes
in
Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Well, you have a fully funded pension system. You have bills getting paid on time. You have much more efficiency.
All right. Story we're going to remember in 5, 10, 15, 20, 15.
It's going to be just sitting here talking to you, Justin.
500 years. This segment's going to be the one they find in the toxic dust of Earth, and they go,
it's going to be in a time capsule.
And how
somewhere.
Do you press play on this thing? And they'll be like, hey, welcome to the download.
I kind of struggled with this one because just wasn't like some big moving story. But I mean, does the Trump-Putin meeting, will that go down in history? First time they're sitting down, world leaders. David's kind of shaking his head. I don't know.
That's a good one, though. That's historic in a way that we're
especially if something happens with Trump where he goes down in flames because of the Russian connections. That meeting will be looked at and talked about and transcribed and written about for years to come.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Well,
yeah.
And I think what you're alluding to is these when we go to the 500-year time frame.
Which Justin
it's
set
maybe
for
not
us.
Just what
it.
Happens in
it.
One week, but what's the bigger story here? And so kind of Russia and the U.S. in the age of Trump is, especially if something happens in the domestic scene regarding the president's future, that could be one. I for similar reasons, I put, even though the North Korean nuclear, intercontinental missile test itself is not something we necessarily
that's one to remember.
But given the stakes there, that could be
the missile that was launched this week they say had the capacity, was the first one had the capacity to actually hit Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Like the other ones.
It could draw us into war. And so, yeah.
And you hear the what's coming out of the Trump administration, sort of very, very serious things. The word things, so it's a weird word to throw into the policy. And
yeah. The trouble with that whole situation is that you know, they're not the first administration to kind of shake their finger at North Korea and say, this is, you know, don't do that again. And it, you know, they keep doing that and there are no real repercussions. With this president, though, you never know. I mean, he might try something other presidents have not been willing to try.
Right.
But when you have Seoul, South Korea within less than 100 miles from the border, you know, millions of people will die before the dust settles, even if it's just a conventional war situation between North and South Korea.
So I mean, it's
stakes are incredibly high.
I'll say this about, you know, I'm not paid that close attention to world politics and geopolitics and even the region, but to recognize the situation in Korea, and it's from talking to people on the show, Seoul is 40 miles from the North Korean border where there are missiles.
Mm-hmm.
It would take one incoming to wipe out hundreds of thousands of people. And I think that's always been the sticky wicket of how they negotiate, because they have missiles pointed at a mm-hmm. very, very large city, much larger than Chicago, that would be like if they had, you know, missiles in, I don't know,
Barrington.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that makes it a lot more difficult to negotiate or to threaten any sort of, you know, sort of military action.
And especially when North Korea, whatever their conventional weapons are not in line with what the South Koreans would have, but they just have body after body they can throw into any kind of armed conflict. It's very scary.
And I will go Black China and Rob Kardashian.
I thought you were going to.
I thought about it over the break, and I'm like, they will start the Rob and China show. And it'll be the largest rated show of all time. It'll be the biggest hit.
For 5 years, and 10 years, 500 years.
They'll get statues. They'll get an Oscar, even though it's a TV show. And then everyone will look back in 500 years. When Rob Kardashian becomes president. I mean, there's a lot.
New forms of media will be invented in order to be able to kind of adequately deal with
this.
The
new planet that we live on, we call Kardashian. So
You nailed it.
All right. Kristen McQuarrie, she's the editorial board member at Chicago Tribune. David Greising, Midwest Bureau Chief for Reuters. You guys, thanks so much for playing tonight.
Thanks, Justin.
So fun to have you guys. I really appreciate it. All right, so let's get an update on tonight's news. Coming up, reality check. Speaking of reality television, I don't think we'll talk Kardashian, you know, Rob Kardashian, Black China, but it is the premiere of Spouse House. Spouse House is coming up on Sunday, so reality check coming up here after the break. So great, huh? Reloading this week's news. Got some more texts in as well before we get to Tracy and the reality check segment. 312 says, to all the people who claim they're moving to Wisconsin or Indiana, I say good luck. I lived in Wisconsin for 5 years. I moved back and I saved money. Yeah, I noticed that a lot today. I'm moving. My buddy Gary had a great Facebook post where he said, you know how much money, or it was about, you know how much money it is to move? Like from across a state line, if you're doing it because of taxes, you're never going to recoup that savings. So it's like, it's kind of a zero. But Kristen kind of pointed it out. I mean, you know, it's less about the tax and it's more about what they do with the money. And they find themselves every 3 years in the same predicament, you know, where if you live in a different state, the pensions are funded and, you know, you're not in such dire situation every 2 or 3 years. And it made me think, you know, do you remember this, Pete? I remember being so frustrated when I would get on the bus, the CTA bus, and this is, I'm dating myself, probably like a 2007, 2006, a Rod Blagojevich, Mike Madigan showdown over the budget. And it was so bogus that I would get on the bus to go to Navy Pier. That's where we're working. And the announcement would go like, do you care about schools? Do you care about the bus that you're on? Then let your state legislator know that we need to balance a budget. That was the next stop, Damon. That was on and you were like, what is this? Like, what dysfunction are you cutting promos over? Like, who's doing this on the CTA? It was all about mass transit funding and making sure it was in the budget, whatever it was. And I was just like, so Kristen's right. Like, this idea that that was like a doomsday. Mike Madigan and Rob Blagojevich staring each other down. Doomsday. We don't have enough money to pay for any of this stuff. That's 2006, 2007. And here we are, and it's the same rhetoric. We don't have the money. Doomsday. And so there is something to be said about, all right, you know, maybe at a certain point, yeah, you move to a different state. And the taxes may be similar, but there's not this doomsday scenario every time we get to budget time. I don't know.
I just enjoyed the CTA message from Jay Cutler. Hey, this is Jay Cutler. And he'd look up and like, where is this coming from?
Hey, if you see something, say something. Hi, I'm Jay Cutler. Don't throw an interception. Like, was it something funny like that? Hey, it's 3rd and 7. Make sure you screen your pass. Are you going to run or are you going to pass? Hi, I'm Jay Cutler. Don't you pass on the safety of other riders. All right, time for reality check. This is a segment we do every Friday night here on The Download where we talk about the Chicago storylines and contestants that are on reality television. As we know, Tracy Swartz is the ink columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and she joins us every Friday night. Tracy, how are you? Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I was hoping to tell you guys that if you don't like Chicago, you could always try moving to the spouse house in L.A.
That has Chicago people on it.
It has Chicago people on it, but, I mean, it looks pretty cool. It has a pool and a hot tub, and what could go wrong?
So this is the big week we've been waiting for. This weekend, Spouse House premieres.
Yes.
Before we get
Sunday
into
night.
Sunday night. So let's get back, because we've talked a little bit about Spouse House. Tell us the premise of Spouse House, and then we'll get into who the contestants are. But the premise of Spouse House.
It's a very difficult premise, and I have to tell you, I asked for a screener for the show, and they wouldn't give it to me, which is usually not a good sign.
Uh-oh.
For a show. It's either going to be so horrible it's good, or just so horrible it's bad. So Spouse House premieres yeah. on Sunday, and it starts with 14 Chicagoans. Who have to go out to LA, and basically they either have to get engaged or move out of the house. So it's very confusing to me how this works, and they haven't really described it very well. You have to pair up, and then if you don't get engaged, like two people get kicked off, and then they bring two new people in. So the entire city of Chicago could be parading through this house at the rate they're going. I have no idea. So yeah, the premise is not very strong. It's not something I've seen before. But we got 14 people who you can go on the Tribune website. I have pictures and descriptions of everybody. But yeah, it's sure enough to be confusing because who wants to go to a house in LA and then immediately get engaged a few days later? They do show. So they wouldn't give me the screener, but I saw a clip, and in this clip, there was, of course, fighting in the hot tub, loving in the hot tub, foot massages, a guy dancing with a rose in his mouth. And it looked like there was at least one wedding. So it looks like the spouse house worked for at least two people.
At least two people. And what? Okay, so what's the Chicago connection to spouse house?
All of the contestants are from the Chicago area.
So all of them are there. Yet they go to L.A. for... Are they acting like they're in Chicago, or is it the idea that we flew them out here to Los Angeles?
Yeah, they're not acting. They're like it's Chicago, because where in Chicago are you going to find this really nice pool and this hot tub for debauchery? And it was, you know, I was thinking
Melrose
about that.
Park?
Like,
I don't
know. Why are we, you know, why are we flying these people out there? But I think it is just the fact that they filmed it early, like in the winter, springish. So I don't think they wanted to have everybody in, like, their winter coats hanging out and, you know, drinking and getting putting on their winter weight. They wanted people outside in the bikinis, which is where it looks like all the drama is happening.
All right. So, again, it's a show that says all these people – is the idea that they say it, all these people are from Chicago. Like, I mean, why is I don't understand why everyone has to be from Chicago if they shoot it in Los Angeles. Right.
Because they need a place, and it's funny because we have a lot of reality shows filming here or taking a lot of Chicago people. I mean, we have the Married at First Sight. We've got one coming up where it's the Black Ink Crew, which is like follows a Pilsen tattoo shop. This is like an unprecedented number of reality contestants from Chicago, like on Chicago-centric shows. Normally, you know, we get, you know, maybe a couple Chicago people on The Bachelorette, a couple people on American Idol, like that kind of stuff. And this is very Chicago-centric. And they needed to pick a place where they could get everybody from the area because they wanted to make sure that it would be geographically friendly for them. You can't have people from all over the country. This is the one of the problems with The Bachelorette, and one of the reasons why the couples don't work out well there is because you're like, well, this person is from Dallas, and they have to move their life over, you know, to Madison, Wisconsin. It makes sense to pick people from one geographic area. Hmm. And I just think that maybe some of these reality producers think that Chicago's more desperate than New York or LA. I don't know. They're more willing to literally get engaged 4 days after meeting someone or get married at first sight.
That's I just have this picture in a production office where they're like, how about Miami? No, not desperate enough. Austin, Texas? No. What about Chicago? And they all go, yes, very desperate.
I mean, you have to be willing. Do you know how many people applied for that Married at First Sight show this season to be in Chicago? 40,000 people.
What?
40,000 people applied to marry a stranger that you have no idea their name, what they look like, nothing. You meet them at the altar, maybe you shake hands, and then you're married. Legally married. 40,000 people applied to be on that show.
Wow. So Spouse House airs on Sunday.
Sunday night on the TLC network. That's the Learning Channel. So hopefully you learn something. Hopefully there's some lessons that come out of this show.
Now, of course, you know, we have followed closely The Bachelorette, you know, but as that has been the lead for us for so many weeks. But now, as we talked about last week, Chicago is not represented. They're gone.
All the Chicago people are gone. Plus, this week there was no new episode of The Bachelorette because of the holiday. Most of the reality shows were off. The only reality show that I follow that was on was Married at First Sight.
Sure.
So just to recap, again, strangers marrying strangers have 8 weeks to decide if they want to stay married or get divorced. We're nearing the home stretch. There's only a couple episodes left. And they basically, this episode featured the couples, all three couples, meeting for the first time at a brunch at Carnival. And first of all, I've never seen Carnival so empty for this episode.
Yeah, they cleared filmed, it out, right?
Yeah, they cleared it out. They filmed earlier in the episode at Pequod's. And again, there are definitely people in Pequod's, but I've never seen it where there's like aisles clear where you can walk through Pequod's. I was like, what day was this? I got to follow this this filming around so I can get a table at some of these restaurants.
There you go.
So they went to Carnival, and it's the three couples, and they're just on the show. They're weeks away. This was filmed in the fall, but on the show, they're weeks away from deciding if they want to stay married. And essentially what went down was that one of the couples has not had sex yet on the show.
Okay.
So they're in the friend zone. It doesn't look like they'll be climbing out of that friend zone. And they basically shared this information with the two other couples who have been intimate. And it was like a bomb had dropped at Carnival. Carnival is such a fun place. It's like it's so festive. And then I very rarely think that abstinence is ever the topic of conversation at a brunch there. But that's what happened.
It's a Carnival brunch.
On Thursday brunch.
With a show like this, I mean, do they do it where at the end everyone makes the choice? Or are they going each episode at the end, you find out whether or not they want to stay together?
No, so they're basically they're filming, and then at the end of the series, they tell you whether or not they want to stay married or get divorced. So you can see where the little cracks and the problems lie, but they won't tell you until I think that episode airs at the end of this month, maybe early August, where they say, hey, we're getting married, or hey, we're staying married, or hey, we're getting divorced. And some of these couples have worked out. One of the couples from the first season is having a baby pretty soon. Some of the couples definitely do not work out, and restraining orders are filed.
Come on. Do you, I mean, is it, as a reporter, As someone who you have the reporting background, the column, you can suss out, because these shows are taped in advance. You sussed out that some of the Chicago guys weren't going to make it because they were on Instagram or whatever, putting themselves in Mexico where Bachelor in Paradise was. In this case, I mean, these shows are taped, right? So
right.
I mean, do you find yourself spoiling it yourself? I mean, can you figure it out from finding the contestants and their social media profiles or articles about them that essentially give away what happened on the shows?
This one's a little bit tougher because all of the people on the show are tweeting, and they post pictures not really telling what's happening. From watching the show, I have an idea, I think, of which ones are going to stay married. But yeah, this one is not as easy. There's fewer spoilers out there than you would imagine. So I've been definitely keeping my eye. I'm doing my reporter thing and checking my different avenues of trying to figure out what's what. I had some idea, like, you know, where people worked and that kind of stuff. And they're trying to keep a lot of that stuff out of the
show,
media,
yeah.
Off the show, because they don't want people showing up people's workplaces,
right,
and stuff.
They
and I imagine, I imagine some of these employers maybe wouldn't want to see their names thrown out there when someone's having a meltdown. But yeah, so it'll be interesting. Like I said, I have kind of in my head where I think that people go, but people have surprised me on the show.
Tracy, when is Married at First Sight air, and where? And
it airs Thursday nights at 8 p.m. on Lifetime. And even if you maybe haven't, it's really not difficult to pick up an episode if you haven't seen the 13 before, because they do a lot of rehashing on the show. Sometimes I'm watching the same argument over like three episodes, and I'm like, I've already seen this before. So it's not hard
previously
to pick up. Previously on, and you're like, wait a minute, this half of this episode is just rehashing the cornhole argument of last week.
One of my favorite arguments of all time.
But if you don't even want to watch it for the married couples, watch it for the Chicago scenery, because it's interesting to pick out like where they go. And this show, we knew that they were filming at the Palmer House in August, but they didn't really file permits for the rest of the season. So it's always kind of been a surprise to me as I'm watching the show, like, oh, this is where they're at. Or, you know, it was surprising that they were able to keep the show so secret when they're on places like the Riverwalk,
pretty damn young. Yeah, I guess you're right. As a reporter, you just go find out where the permits were filed.
And for the most part, that works. But, you know, this stayed on the radar. Part of the reason is some of the couples are out in the suburbs, so that cuts down on it. But they do a good job of showing a lot of Chicago scenery.
Yeah, that's what Christine says. She says most of these contestants are not from the city. They're from the suburbs, like Fox Lake or DeKalb.
Well, I have to tell you, one of the guys, most of the people lived in the city. One woman lived out in Arlington Heights, but four of them lived in the city. Four people in the city, one in Arlington Heights, and then one of the guys was out in Genoa. And that's a bit of a stretch to call it the Chicago area.
Is that how you pronounce it? I always thought it was Genoa.
That's what I thought, too, but I was actually driving out to Iowa a couple weeks ago, and I thought someone pronounced it Genoa, and I was like, oh, I've been pronouncing it wrong, but I was like, why do I need to know how to pronounce it, except for the show where they say it's Chicago area people, but, I mean, if you're living out in Genoa and your wife is living in Chicago, they compromised and lived out in Barrington, but it also seems to be a bit of a strain on the relationship. That's not really geographically desirable to be, you know, if right. you're living in the city, to move out there. In New York, it was a problem too. The first season of this show was set in New York, and it's like, if you have someone living out in Jersey and you're living in Manhattan, you know, that's something to think about. But yeah, it was surprising to me that 40,000 people applied and one of the Chicago area contestants is from Genoa.
All right, Tracy, last question. And this is there a Rob Kardashian Black China show coming up?
No, there was a show last year that documented their life together, and they had been gearing up to film another one, but they've gone through so many problems. I have to tell you, I was obsessed with that drama this week. It felt like that was the only celebrity news that was going on.
You would have loved the last segment where I tried to explain it to David Greising and Kristen McQuarrie, who had not heard of it. And I'm like, okay, so, all right, so, okay. So, Tyga, okay, let me back up. I didn't do a good job of it, but.
Did you compare them to, like, Madigan Ronner? Like, if, like, Madigan had posted pics of Ronner, this is how this would have gone. Like, maybe you had to frame it in sort of.
Maybe put in state house politics.
So
there is no plan. So this is real drama. I kind of made a joke at the top of the show that it felt like it was manufactured drama for E, and coming up on Tuesday night will be the Robin China show season two.
No, it seems like, first of all, this relationship looked fraught from the beginning because of all the complications with basically, you know, Black China had a baby with Kylie Jenner, who is Rob Kardashian's sister, Kylie Jenner's boyfriend, and it looked like it was doomed from the beginning. They got pregnant really quickly. You knew it wasn't going to last, and they've broken up and had, you know, stuff happen on Twitter before, but yeah, this isn't to drum up a show. It looks like she is dating someone else, and Rob Kardashian's really mad about it, and unfortunately, they have, like, a 7-month-old daughter who's caught in the middle of this.
And reality becomes reality in this case, right?
But she's a Kardashian, so she's going to have to grow up with this, right? This is going to be par for the course. She's learning really young.
Well, we'll skip that part. I just want to know if they had a show coming up. Tracy Swartz, the Ink columnist for the Chicago Tribune. You can read her stuff there. She joins us every Friday night for our segment Reality Check. Tracy, have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too.
All right, coming up, 10 o'clock hour tonight. Very excited to have two great Chicago performers in studio, Susan McLaughlin Karp and Tony Rogers. Both of which were members of Writer's Block Party, great segment, radio show, podcast, CD, everything in between, produced by genius Amy Krauss Rosenthal. And if you're a fan of this show, you know that we tributed her life. She died of cancer back in the spring, winter spring. And, you know, I kind of talked at that time about, you know, whether or not we should do a big show where people come in and we tribute or play some of the stuff, or at least, you know, talk about her legacy. And we did when she passed. But this weekend, the Kerry Secrest Gallery in West Loop is going to be opening an exhibit called AKR, A Beauty Salon. It's going to be on display, some of her writings, some of her art, video installations, all sorts of stuff. And tomorrow night, they asked if, you know, I could put together something, and I put together a list of, or sort of a show. Five or six writers and performers who worked with Amy are going to perform, including Tony and Susan, who will be here in studio tonight to give you a preview of that. John Green will be there, Mark Baser, Claire Zulke, Steve Delahoyd. Great lineup tomorrow night for the opening. It's a fundraiser for Amy's Yellow Umbrella Foundation. So we'll talk about Amy's impact, but we'll also get some performance coming up here in the 10 o'clock hour tonight on The Download. Thank you, Rob. Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. With you till 11 o'clock tonight, Patty Vasquez taking over at 11. Well, starting this weekend, the Kerry Secrest Gallery in the West Loop is opening up a new exhibit called AKR, A Beauty Salon. It's a collection of some of Amy's projects, from writings to art to video installations that all highlight the work of the great Chicago writer who died from cancer earlier this year. It's being guest curated by her longtime collaborator, Ruby Western. Of course, Amy Krauss Rosenthal, we talked a lot about Amy when she passed. It was winter, spring time, and we talked about it on the show, and we did a lot there. And I'd always talked about the idea of getting some of her collaborators together. And with the opening of this exhibit, what a great time to do that. In honor of the launch of this exhibit and to raise money for the AKR Yellow Umbrella Foundation, an organization dedicated to ovarian cancer research, there's a fundraiser tomorrow night at the gallery. You can find out all the details at secrestgallery.com. See, I helped put this little show tomorrow together for the opening, right? I worked with Amy for years, whether it was on radio projects like Writer's Block Party or websites like Mission Amy KR. I had the great fortune to collaborate with her. And tomorrow night, a crew of writers and performers will give back to Amy since she gave so much to us. The lineup includes John Green, the famed young adult author who's written books like Fault in Our Stars and Paper Towns. He got his start writing from Amy Cross Rosenthal. Also, Mark Baser from The Interview Show, Claire Zulke and Steve Delahoyd from Funny Haha will perform. And my guest tonight will also perform, Tony Rogers and Susan McLaughlin Karp. Both were longtime contributors to Amy's Writer's Block Party on Chicago Public Radio. Tony's a longtime Chicago musician, played with his band The Good, as well as several other projects, including the Alpha Bites, short films and songs. WTTW, love that stuff. My kid grew up on that stuff, Tony.
Good.
There was a point where he kind of was doing it. And I'm like, that's Tony. That's crazy. All right. And Susan McLaughlin Karp is an essayist here in Chicago. She was part of a playwright collective at the Timeline Theater, as well as a performer in town at live lit shows like Write Club. Susan, great to see you.
Great to be here.
All right. How about it? We did it. We got together. Good to see you guys.
Yeah, this is great.
All right. So, you know, this is, I mean, the exhibit starts tomorrow and it runs through August 12th at the Seacrest Gallery in the West Loop. You know, I mean, for you guys, talk about your relationship, working relationship, your personal relationship, but what Amy meant to you guys as performers and artists here in Chicago.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, at first I heard of Amy. I think there was an article, I found it looking online in the Reader years ago. I think it's like from like 2000 or 2001, and it's called Funny Girl. And it was by Michael Glubb, and he talks to Amy, and she's like at the beginning of her genius, I guess. Like her,
right,
I think Paris was like 3 years old when they did this interview, and it's like her working at the coffee shops and doing stuff out of Urbis Orbis, and how she's still like a mom and taking care of her kids and trying to like balance like and be a good mom and figure out how to find time to make art. And I thought, well, I'd really like to meet this woman. Like, she seems to be having what I would like, and she seems like fun and, you know, like cool, I guess, like, or I'm gonna hate her, I'm not sure which, you know. And
it
I think
go one way or the other at that point, right?
And
or both, right?
Yeah, right. Like Black Spider-Man or whatever, right? But so I, you know, I think it was truly due to the internet that I emailed her, because if I had, like, before internet, I don't know that I would have been tracking her home
number, or something. Right.
So, and she was just, I was like, would you ever want to get together and I could ask you questions? And she was like, on it. She's like, boom, let's do it. Like, we'll meet at this coffee shop at 3:00, and like, she was just total blast, you know, so much energy. And like she just, I don't know how she had time to have coffee with me and like the 3,000 other people probably had coffee with that month. And, but she was all just like, bring it. It's great. It's good. Let's do this. Like, she was just like,
Tony, is that, I mean, talk about how you met Amy and how you started getting involved with her.
Yeah, well, I met Amy through a mutual friend. So my bandmate Devin Ark and Amy went to college together. And so I met her through him just as a friend. And Devin and I had a band, The Good, and she would come to see us play sometime. And you know, he introduced me to her writing. And so we were aware of each other. We became friends. And then at some point, she asked me to collaborate musically on something that she had written. And I think the first thing might have been for the Little P book, the children's book that she wrote.
She's an avid children's book author of New York Times bestseller. But yeah, just, yeah, that's how a lot of people know her.
Yeah.
It's surprising. I mean, we know her from the artistic community here in Chicago, but she has a massive amount of fans from the Little P, all the Duck, Duck, Rabbit. Like, you can go down a list of some of the best children's stories.
Yeah, I'm constantly walking into friends' houses and they're like, oh my god, you know the author of this book, right? Like Little Hoot, that's my kid's favorite book, right? So Amy kind of introduced me to the concept of songwriting as adaptation, really, because she, up to that point, you know, we had just been writing about things that we were interested in, which seemed like a totally legitimate thing to do.
Of course, right? Right.
But she had this idea that, you know, the stuff that she was doing would be enhanced if somebody else took their take on it. And she didn't really know what would come of it. Like, it wasn't like there was going to be a CD included in the book or anything like that. But she gave me an early copy of Little P, which, she did all of her children's books. She would do these stick figure drawings of, and she would create like versions of the books that have the plastic binding collating, you know, from Kinko's. And so I have somewhere like this original Little P book
awesome.
That she gave me. I wrote a song. I wrote a couple of songs because she didn't love the first one I wrote. So she asked me to do another one. But the process was so rewarding that there were a few projects throughout her career that she would ask me, would you write something for this? And I was always, always happy to do it.
Tony Rogers and Susan McLaughlin Karp in studio tonight. We're talking about the legacy of Amy Krauss Rosenthal, great writer, artist, collaborator. She is a New York Times bestselling author. She also had done so much more as a filmmaker. Also did Writer's Block Party on Chicago Public Radio, which we'll talk about in this, you know, where you both collaborated together. Yeah. Let's do this. Let's take a break so we can stay on time. And then, Tony, I want you go first. Give us some performance. You brought your guitar tonight.
Yeah.
We could talk a little bit more about Amy. Amy's new exhibit is up at the Carrie Seacrest Gallery in the West Loop. Starts tomorrow. There's a fundraiser for the AKR Yellow Umbrella Foundation at the gallery tomorrow night, 5 to 7. You can find out the details at seacristgallery.com. That's SCCRIST gallery.com. Tony will be there. Susan will be there. I'll be there. Claire Zulke, Mark Baser, John Green, Steve Delahoyd. We'll have a fun time. So that's tomorrow night. We'll get a live performance from Tony and Susan coming up here on The Download tonight. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman here. Talking about the legacy of our great pal, Amy Krauss Rosenthal. She passed away of cancer back this winter spring, and we talked about it a lot on this program, and it was so touching to see how many people she had her life had impacted. I mean, just the news stories and the, you know, there was a lot. She had written the story that was in the New York Times or the essay about, you know, does anyone want to date my husband, which went viral. That was a huge hit. But, I mean, it's so funny because so many people go, oh, yeah, I know her from that. And you're like, she's done a million other things that I feel like were viral even before that. And we even talked about her.
And how crazy is it that that someone can be famous from an essay?
I know, right?
Like, I mean, Amy.
Amy.
Of course.
Right. It's perfect. Anyway, in studio tonight, Tony Rogers and Susan McLaughlin Karp both are going to be performing tomorrow night at the fundraiser for the AKR Yellow Umbrella Foundation and the opening of the AKR A Beauty Salon. It's an art exhibit that is on Amy's work that will be on the walls of the Seacrest Gallery in West Loop. We'll be performing there tomorrow night. I'll be there. Tony will be there. Susan will be there. John Green will be there. Mark Baser, Claire Zulke, Steve Delahoyd, a lot of great Chicago artists who will be performing and giving back to Amy because she gave so much to us. Tony, I teased it out before that you're going to play some stuff. If you can't make it to the fundraiser tomorrow night, I'm going to give you guys a sneak peek tonight. Tony and Susan both performing some of the stuff they'll do tomorrow night. What do you want to perform? What are you doing?
Well, I have a lot of things to choose from, and I thought a lot about this. You know, I talked about the Little P stuff that I wrote for her. I also wrote a handful of songs for her Encyclopedia of an Ordinary Life book.
Right.
That was super fun. I did a theme song once for an event she had called the Algonquinstein Roundtable.
I was there.
You were there?
Yeah. I was.
I'm pretty sure that's where I met Mark Baser. With your old radio show, the Writer's Block Party, mm-hmm. I did a series of fake commercials. I've begged you for the archive.
I don't have it.
You don't have it.
Somewhere it's in a box, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's in a box somewhere. So I don't really, I can't remember, I can't play them, but I remember this snippet from we did a commercial for El Palmar, the burrito place up north.
Yeah, right.
And the one couplet that I remember is, where English is served, even if it's not spoken, Como se dice, the waitress is smoking.
That was one of our, that was the wrap-up line on that song. That was good. Yeah. That jingle.
So, I mean, they would have used it, I'm sure.
I'm sure they would have.
Captured it. But she was great she was so great at collaborating and combining different media. But the song that I want to play tonight is a song that's really meaningful to me for a couple different reasons. And it's a song that she completely rejected. It's a song. She was making a film called The Beckoning of Lovely.
Of course, yeah.
And she said she wanted music for it. Could I give her some? And I wrote a song, and the song is called Let's Make a Movie. And I was going through a kind of a brutal divorce at the time. And so I wrote a song that's possibly darker than what Amy was looking for. Because I think she was trying to make this
She's writing a movie called The Beckoning of Lovely. She's right. Like, can I get a soundtrack? You're like, yeah, let me give it to you.
Yeah, yeah. So
let me tell you where I'm at.
Right. So I gave her something, and she was like, oh, wow, that's really great. It's not really what I'm looking for. And, you know, she ended up using some other song of mine. It was great. It was fine. It was much better suited to what she was doing. But so I had the song, Let's Make a Movie, and I liked it. And I was like, oh, well, whatever. Like, it'll sit in the bank of songs that never went anywhere, right? Not doing anything. And then completely separate from that, a few years later, my band, The Good, who had been dormant for a long time, got an opportunity to make... Somebody came up and said, a producer, and said, we want to make a new record by The Good. And we're like, okay. And I had this epiphany that was, you know, this song, Let's Make a Movie, it had been just kind of bouncing around my head forever. And I said, what we should do is we should make the most epic record we've ever made. We should make this two-record set that is all songs about movies. And the very last song should be Let's Make a Movie. And so we did. That's exactly what we did. And we put out the record last year, and Let's Make a Movie is the last song on it. But that's not the end of the story. So the end of the story is, at the end of that recording, on the last day in the studio for recording that record, Devin Arkin, who was my bandmate and best friend for decades, was diagnosed with stage 4 glioblastoma brain cancer. And he died from it about a year after that. And in the hospital, as you know, he had just gotten out of surgery, I got a call from Amy. And Amy told me about her diagnosis. So both of them happened within days of each other. And, you know, we know what happened with Amy. And the incredible thing to me, you know, she loved serendipity, right? She loved magic, and she loved connecting things. And you know, so I thought about that a lot whenever I was with her. And it was a crazy kind of closure for this song, kind of writing it for her, finishing it with Devin. And I wouldn't even know her if it wasn't for Devin. So there was a lot of synchronicity. So this song is called Let's Make a Movie.
All right.
And I'm going to play it.
Tony Rogers.
If we make a movie, will it be a scary one? Will you play the villain, but I won't know that you're one until approximately 50 minutes into the film. Scary movies are fun, fun movies are sad, if you're the one that they laugh at, and sad movies are good, good movies are something we could make together. When does your performance make a clean break from your thing about this process is we're not always in control. In fact, we might as well just let the cameras roll and ad lib. La 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 la. Scary movies are fun, fun movies are sad, if
you're the one that they laugh at. And sad movies are good, good movies are something we could make together. Hold the light, I'll read the part, we'll get our shot. Here in the dark, I won't be shy, just wait and see, let's make it real. You'll say cut when we can't go anymore. Or will one of us be holding a gun and looking down into a red and fiery pit of revenge? Let's make a movie. Let's make a movie. Let's make a movie that we'll watch again and again. Let's make a movie. Let's make a movie. Let's make a movie that will outlive us, and then let's make a movie. Let's make a movie. Let's make a movie that will never, ever end. Ever.
Yes, there you go, there you go. Tony Rogers in studio tonight.
So it was a little darker than she was.
Awesomely so.
That was a good dark. Yes. It was a good dark. Tony Rogers, a great musician here in town, played his band The Good for a number of years, as well as other projects, including the Alphabet short films, songs on WTTW for the kids section. Tony, of course, going to be playing tomorrow night as part of the fundraiser to raise money for the AKR Yellow Umbrella Foundation, a foundation that's dedicated to ovarian cancer research and the legacy of writer and performer and filmmaker and producer and friend Amy Krauss Rosenthal, who passed away this past winter, spring. Tony and Susan McLaughlin Carp will both be performing tomorrow night alongside author John Green, host Mark Baser, Claire Zolke and Steve Delahoyd from Funny Haha. So a great lineup of people performing who had connection, collaborated with Amy Krauss Rosenthal, just like Tony did right here. And so that's just, I mean, you nailed it. The idea of serendipity and magic. And when you get a chance to collaborate with someone like Amy, you don't just do it, you feel it.
Yeah.
That really is kind of how, you know, when you look back on it, that's how it feels, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so here's what we'll do. We'll take a break so we can get an update on tonight's news, and then we will Susan McLaughlin Carp will read some of the stuff. And we should have done a show tomorrow of stuff that was rejected by Amy. Like, oh, I just thought about it. I was like, yeah, every one of the writers would have had some stuff that was rejected, because she was ultimately the producer and curator and editor for Writer's Block Party and other things. And I just realized when you were playing that, I'm like, I've got stuff. I'm sure you do, Susan.
Yeah.
I know that John does. I know that Mark does. I don't know why I didn't think about that. We still got 24 hours, or not even 18 at this point. But. All right, here we go. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman here. Tony Rogers, Susan McLaughlin Carp in studio tonight. We are talking. I mean, it's great to see you guys. It's been a while since I've seen you. And great to have you in studio. We all work together on a collaboration, the Writer's Block Party, which is Amy Krauss Rosenthal's great show within a show at Chicago Public Radio. And, the you know, Amy, of course, passed away this past winter, spring from cancer. And her AKR Yellow Umbrella Foundation, an organization dedicated to ovarian cancer research, is holding a fundraiser tomorrow night for the opening of her art exhibit, which is great, AKR, a beauty salon, which is being guest curated by her longtime collaborator, Ruby Western. It's going to be tomorrow night, this fundraiser from 5 to 7. Tony will be there. Susan will be there. I'll be there. John Green will be there. Mark Baser, Claire Zulke, Steve Delahoy. It'll be a great show. All people who have worked at one point or another, collaborated with Amy, performing. So you can get all the details at seacrestgallery.com. There may be, and it may be sold out, but I don't know, Seacrest. S-E-C-R-I-S-T gallery.com. So Tony, perform for us. Susan McLaughlin Carp, essayist and writer who is in live lit shows here in Chicago at his Write Club, great with Ian Belknap Company, also playwright, and also has done her own solo shows in Chicago. Good to see you. It's like I said, it's great to see you guys. So you told us before you met Amy, reached out to her, but you had done a lot of pieces for Amy in Writer's Block Party. And the fun part about Writer's Block Party is the stuff was super short. Like, it was a 5-minute radio show within another radio show. That was the idea.
Which is incredibly hard, I think. It's so much easier to write a half-hour piece than, like, a 3-minute piece or a 1-minute piece. I think about that all the time with Amy, because she was so good at boiling things down to a very small bite.
How do you do that?
Bite.
I mean, really, that's hard to do, like, to even submit a piece that's going to be 30 seconds long.
Right. I'm just warming up. Then, like, it right. takes me forever to get to a point, but yeah, so it was really good exercise to try. I remember I was like, Justin, Amy, I can do like great 10-minute pieces, and you're like,
the show's
no.
10 minutes, and there's right. 5 different performers, right?
Right.
Yeah, so, Tony, some of those songs we did were like 30 seconds long.
They were all 30. That's why we did commercials, because they had to be super short,
right? Yeah. Well, I remember, too, like, we were talking about Amy curating stuff and just not taking stuff. And for me, it was really funny because I'd send her, like, 5 things. And she'd never say anything about – she'd just be like, I like that one. You know, and you're like – there was no conversation, really, right. about it. Like, about why she wouldn't like it or what she might want. Like, she wasn't that kind
of – She'd say number 3.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was it. That was done. Like, she didn't ever try to shape my work. Like, she always, I think, could find something in people's work that was, that, like, she liked, that resonated. But she never tried to, like, get her mitts in it and mold it. Like,
that's, I mean, there's something to be said about that. I mean, because a lot of editors, especially when it's their project and their name on it, they, and I worked alongside with Amy on this, and I noticed how she would say, the idea was she would pick your piece. She would give you that sort of purity, that creative purity. But it was from, you submitted 5 pieces. She said, this is the one, but she didn't get in there and try to massage it or change it or shorten it or anything like that.
Right. I think it's like a lack of ego. Cause I think, you know, you kind of get your, when I edit people's stuff, I'm kind of like, well, my version of that would be, you know, like yours is really kind of not so good, but like we can make it better if we do it my way. But like right. Amy had none of that. I don't think she had time for that. Like, she was more like about like, come to the party, here's a drink, have a great time, you know, or don't, but like you're invited.
I got you here, right. Right. All right, so what are you going to perform for us tonight?
Well, I wrote something about Amy and iPhones, kind of.
All right, great. So, world premiere.
Right.
We'll take it. Susan McLaughlin Carp here on the download.
I found this on my computer. This summer of 2008, I have a 6-month-old baby, 3 dogs, 4 small children total, a babysitter and a husband. I just bought an iPhone because it has an alarm function that will notify you before you need to be someplace. I'll never be late again. And that same summer of 2008, on 8-8-08, which was my 41st birthday, I was at the Bean in Millennium Park at the beckoning of Lovely with my husband and my 4 boys. I watched from the sidelines as so many people came to connect with Amy. And that night in my mind, I watched as Amy got released into the universe like a paper lantern that floats beautifully and magically into the night. And in my mind, Amy became a public figure that night, like a global rock star of the heart. Amy was the kid on the playground who saw you watching and invited you to join in the game, and not because she felt sorry for you, but because she believed you would be fun to play with. And for those of us who tend to be watching life from the sidelines, feeling like outsiders, to be invited by her was more than a kindness. It was a validation of our worth. I think, unlike some people I've met who believe that real artists belong in tiny clubhouses that aren't big enough for more than a very select few, Amy truly believed that all of us had some quality that made us worth hearing, worth watching, worth hugging. And her enthusiasm steamrolled over any artistic posturing, like rock crushes scissors. She'd just throw you the ball and hope you scored a touchdown. So on that night of 8-8-0-8, it was possibly, in my mind, the last beautiful thing before the world economic crisis, before we moved to the deep suburbs, and before I bought that iPhone. Oh, and there was Facebook that year, too. And after 2008, I want to say that good things didn't really come to a halt. Things got shitty in fits and starts. There were tumbles down laundry chutes here, a flooded basement there, a behaviorally challenged autistic child. There were breast biopsies and sick parents and basement floods again and behaviorally challenged non-autistic child. Perhaps it was exhaustion. Perhaps it was my raging solitaire addiction, thank you iPhone, or binge watching Nurse Jackie, and all of a sudden so many years have passed and I haven't seen people I love in years. I haven't talked to people in years. I just like them or love their Facebook posts. I'm connectedly disconnected. I'm old enough now to have learned not to take happiness for granted. I'm old enough to know not to take loved ones for granted. I know that no matter how good things are, they can get effed up rather quickly, be it human error or Jungian shadow, Barack Obama to Donald Trump for a ham-fisted metaphor. I've learned that memories of happy times sustain you when things get unbearably hard and you find yourself saying, I just can't take this anymore. I'm old enough to know that you really don't know something until you've lived it, and when people give you advice, you do one of the following. A, you reject the notion completely. B, you listen carefully and file it away. C, you merely pretend you are listening, because you can't possibly believe that every home renovation is a nightmare. You will learn it rather from experience, as I did. I knew that staying in touch with old friends is important. I knew that time passes faster and faster every year I'm alive. But I understand that in a different way now. Some people I held dear slipped from my grasp. I regret that there wasn't more. And I'm still not on time. So that is
that's great. Susan McLaughlin Carp. That's great. That's so true. And you were late tonight, so that
yes,
that fits.
Exactly. Yeah, that was like particularly, and it wasn't intentionally I'm to make joking. It more meaningful for you, Justin. If only that had been an
that was
artistic
great.
Decision.
Yeah, well, it was. It should have. You know what? That's the genius of you, that even being late tonight, you found a way to call that back to be into the segment. Susan McLaughlin Carp will be performing along with Tony Rogers. And others at the fundraiser tomorrow night for Amy Krauss Rosenthal, her AKR Yellow Umbrella Foundation. It's an organization dedicated to ovarian cancer research. Amy Krauss Rosenthal, New York Times bestselling author, producer, artist, musician, who passed away from cancer earlier this year. You know, what's it, I mean, for you guys both, I mean, and you you summed it up so eloquently, Susan, just about time, you know, and Tony, you mentioned too, just about, you know, losing friends and serendipity. But I mean, this opportunity as artists to be able to talk about your friend, but also, I mean, to be able to get up on stage and either do things that were inspired by her or things that she actually worked with you. What's that? What does that mean to you as artists to almost collaborate after life?
I'll say that I love that you would think of me in the same thought that you would think of Amy. Honestly, like, I mean, she was, you know, she was such a, I mean, I'm sure we all feel that same way, where, you know, that she, her energy and her creativity and her willingness to just say yes to 5 billion different things were so inspiring that, like, I always felt lucky when she asked me to do anything. So I kind of feel the same way about this.
Like, yeah.
You know, I mean, I miss her for sure, but, like, I love doing something that has anything to do with her.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like I hadn't talked to her in so long, and so there were so many things. Like, I started writing about it. Like, I feel like, in my opinion and my life experience, like, when somebody's sick and you haven't seen them for a while, it's not the time to try to reconnect with them necessarily. Like, and I knew Amy was busy, and I didn't want to insert myself into that. And so I just sent an email. And the day I sent it, like, I got a phone call with, like, a 773 number, and I was like, oh my God, she's calling me back. And I'm like, hello, Amy? Oh my God. And it's this woman who is getting donations, asking for donations for breast cancer research. And I was like, that was, like, serendipitous. Hmm. I thought it was really weird. Like, I gave them, like, $200 instead of. It was just like, and she was like, oh my God, thank you so much. And I was like, it's like this weird, you know.
I mean, you made that point in the piece too, you know, for Amy Cross Rosenthal and even Christine just text in is the book, the Encyclopedia of Ordinary Thoughts, right?
Ordinary Life.
Is that the one she put in random public places? And it, mm-hmm. it's one of, she's done that project before, but you mentioned, you know, in 2008, I mean, even before that, but around that time, I mean, with her books and with the projects that she was working on, and you talk about that, the performances, not just that one, but the one on 10-10-10 and the others, where you started to see her become much more of a public figure, where the work that she had done, the creativity she had given to the world and to Chicago had started to come back to her in the way that she became a best-selling author. All, like you mentioned, I mean, it's so fun to be able to go in to have a kid. And I had my son in 2007, mm-hmm. and it was really fun to go into all those stores, the children's stores, and that's when Amy was at her height, mm-hmm. you know, and just be like, oh yeah, I know who this is, you know, I've worked this. And what I would do is I would take the books and I would pull them out a little bit on the shelf, you know, like, so like people would get a better look at it than the other ones, because there's a lot of books on the children's stuff. And I'm like, I really don't need to do that. But I'm like, I'm still in the mode of like, this is my friend from that I've worked together since 1996. I'm going to try to give her a leg up.
Yeah, I always got
she
excited.
She needs this leg up.
I always got excited when I saw her in the bookstore, right? Like, same thing.
Right. So, but the point is, at some point or another, she did become this public figure that, you know, you'll have this moment, and you've mentioned Urbis Orbis and even the mid-90s and the idea of having these relationships with Amy or even in college. Yeah. And she moved on to be a public figure, even as we saw with the New York Times piece, she was going viral even in her last days. I mean, it's something to remember, the idea that she almost had dual lives.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about her kind of in relation to Andy Warhol, because Andy Warhol was a person who, he wasn't just an interesting person, an artist in his own right, but he also was a connector of people. Like, he pulled a lot of people into his orbit. And I think Amy kind of functioned like that. Like, so many people, so many artists that I know, you and Mark and you know, so many other people, I was kind of connected
Absolutely,
to by her.
Yeah.
Like, she was like a spoke in a giant wheel, so.
Yeah, no, I remember she invited us to go see Pop Psychology, your show, when it was at the Mercury.
Oh, nice.
And when I got there, she introduced us to the Bazers. Like, so she was always, like, getting people. Like,
we didn't pull you on stage, did we?
No, no. Though you played my song suggestion, which was "Cars" by Randy Newman that
here
night.
In my car.
I can't tell you, like, thinking about this, like, and thinking about performing with you. I listened to your CD like obsessively from that show. Like,
that's
amazing. I could. Oh. I can't say. And then I was like, where did it go? Where are all these CDs?
I have
like,
plenty more. Do you want 100? Would you like 200?
Yes, but I downloaded it.
Come to the garage. I'll show you something, right?
Not having a CD player necessarily, I like got it off of Bandcamp yesterday. Yeah. I'm like, I'm getting back into this. Like, it was such a great show.
Thank you.
But like, Amy, like, what was that like? You know, what they... like accomplishing three things in what would just be a social occasion for anyone else, like going to dinner.
You know,
like she's
she's able to. She's I mean
she's
a connector,
operating on all levels.
Tastemaker.
You know?
I mean, you're right. Absolutely,
supporting
Andy
you.
Like, and I think it's fitting that we found a way. And I give this to Amy's family and of course to Ruby and everybody to present and display the work in the form of an exhibit.
Yeah, that's cool.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I mean, she's been a performer and she's been all these things and a writer, not necessarily where you would think in an art exhibit, but it fits perfectly. And she had just in 2016, had started talking about this idea that she wanted to do a show, a curated show called The Beauty Salon.
Yeah.
That was what she was going for, that kind of play off the salon, beauty salon, right. Salon, the variety show type thing. So this is sort of there continuing that thread that she had started. And I think that's awesome. It's admirable. And I think that's a perfect way to be in an art gallery. And it's going to be on display until August 12th at the Seacrest Gallery in the West Loop. Tomorrow night, there is a fundraiser for the opening night. It's opening night tomorrow night. And from 5 to 7, there will be, it's a catered event, and there will be a performance. Tony will be there. Susan will be there. I'll be there. Claire Zolke, Steve Delahoyd, Mark Baser, and John Green will also be there. And everyone will be performing. We'll do sort of like an hour, right? You heard a little bit of what we'll hear tonight. You heard tonight. That'll be there tomorrow. It's SeacrestGallery.com if you're looking for tickets. But if you get a chance in the next month to get down to the West Loop, go see AKR, A Beauty Salon, which will be on display at Seacrest Gallery in the West Loop. Tony, Susan, I'll see you guys tomorrow. Thanks for coming in tonight. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Justin.
Thank you, Justin.
It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. That's going to wrap up the show tonight. Coming up, Patty Vasquez here at 11 o'clock, and we'll be back next week. I'm excited. Next week's going to be, first of all, I'm excited about the show tomorrow night. You know, it's going to be good. It's a fundraiser, so it's expensive. That's the one thing I will say, but it's awesome to get that kind of people together, and it's for a great cause.
Yeah.
The Yellow Umbrella. And it's right in the heart there. The Seacrest Gallery is right in the heart of where the West Loop is like taking off. You know what's right next to? Maria Pinto's shop, the fashion designer that we had on download. We had her on the big table not too long ago.
Hey, make a night of it. Go do some shopping. Go have some food.
That's right. There's the Soho Hotel.
Yeah.
Get a membership. Oh. Go up to the pool. Lots you can do in that neighborhood.
Yeah. Start out
new. It is great because, you know, John Green will be here. John doesn't live here. John... Of course, a monster star with Fault in Our Stars and Paper Towns. He's been on the show as well. But he lived here in Chicago, and he was just this ragtag kid who wasn't really sure what he was going to do in writing. And I don't know how Amy found him, but he wrote this great piece. And I don't know what he's going to perform tomorrow, but he wrote a great piece saying, "What I Learned from Googling My Ex-Girlfriends." And this was 2001, you know, that he did this piece, or 2002. So it was Google was a different thing at that time. And it's this fun piece where he's like, "Elaine lives in Missouri." Like, this is a great piece he did. It was a hit, and he ended up doing a ton of stuff for her. Same with Mark Baser. Mark Baser did a ton of stuff. Claire Zolke. And Steve Delahoyd, the filmmaker, did Beckoning of Lovely, did a ton of short films with Amy. I mean, we talked forever about Amy when she passed back in winter, spring, but she had done so many great projects with video and otherwise. And I think the Andy Warhol, with all the pretensions, get the pretension and what you think of Andy Warhol, like, and his all everything we know in pop culture out of the way. And I do think there are a lot of similarities to what Amy did, where she really found, she found a way to almost just really sort of pinpoint the and focus on the joy of the world. She could look at something right here on Michigan Avenue that nobody else sees and find art in it. In a real way, in a real focused way. That's a, it's not like sort of, oh, look at the light. It's a red light. No, it's green. No, it's not like that, you know. And there's something to it. And I just think that that is a skill as I move along in my life that you don't see that often. You don't see it. And it, I think that that's why she's so, was so successful as a children's author. And be able to present those stories. And you can find on our website, if you go to the download website, we interviewed her twice. She did Big Table twice. But just that idea of being able to present stories and take meaning from things that we don't think about. And that's, you know, that's what made her successful as a writer. So that's coming up tomorrow night. We'll do that Seacrest Gallery. Coming up next week, we got good shows coming up next week. Talk about the budget. We're going to talk about Amazon. On Monday night, we got great shows. We had Al Genie's coming back next week.
Yeah, love that guy.
So, I mean, there's a ton of stuff going on. You got any big plans for the weekend, Rob?
Mr. Rob's going to have to do a little bit of yard work. You know, get out the hedge trimmers. No, you know, a little barbecue get-together tomorrow night, and then Sunday I think we'll probably go to the pool.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, like the pool.
Yeah, I think I might try to do that, too, on Sunday.
It's fun.
With only 30 seconds left on the show tonight, I'll drop the big bomb that I think, and we're not sure yet, but I'm working with Steve Dale, and I think we're going to get a cat.
No.
Steve has been awesome, by the way. Steve Dale, an email to Steve Dale is like, hey, Steve, I'm thinking about getting a cat. And before I even sent it, I got three responses from him.
A cat.
Yeah. And he's good, man. He's got it nailed down to like, he's got it. He knows what he's doing. He makes it the whole system feel like it's yours, you know. I mean, really, it's amazing. He's talking about all kind of breeds and colors and cats and kittens and all this kind of stuff. And I mean, before I even sent the email.
Well, good luck with that.
I'll take your indifference into consideration.
Oh, there's no indifference.
All right. Well, I don't know if it's happening tonight or happening this weekend.
Well, have a good weekend, yeah, right. Nonetheless. All right.